You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Diana Johnstone. Diana is an author based in Paris, France, whose past books include Fool's Crusade, Yugoslavia, NATO, and Western Delusions. Her new book, about which we will be speaking, is Queen of Chaos, The Misadventures of Hillary Clinton. Diana Johnstone, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thank you for talking with me.
And thank you for writing a very timely and very important book about the Queen of Chaos, Hillary Clinton. What motivated you to take this project on?
Not so much the Queen as the chaos. I want to thank you right away because you wrote a review of the book, which I think is very good. And I appreciate that you pointed out that the book is really not mainly about Hillary. She's simply the illustration of the personification of something. The book is much more about chaos than about Hillary. She simply is an instrument of the machine that is creating that worldwide chaos.
Yeah, I really saw the book as a cultural critique of elite neoliberal U.S. Governing culture that went beyond just the one person. But you have a great deal of interest in there about Hillary Clinton. One of the aspects that I thought you had an excellent critique of that I hadn't really seen written about elsewhere was this obsession with genocide, which most people would think of as a good thing. Who's for genocide? We ought to be obsessed with genocide, with eliminating genocide. What's the downside there?
Well, I don't think we need to be obsessed with genocide because, as I point out, most what you can call genocide occurs in wars. And the irony is that this campaign against genocide is actually used quite deliberately, I think, by the U.S. administration to justify wars rather than to prevent them by saying, oh, you know, we have to look out for a potential genocide so that we can wage a preventive war to prevent this genocide that might happen. And the catch there that I stress is that if you wage a war to prevent something and it doesn't happen, then you can always say, oh, it didn't happen because we waged the war. But quite likely, it wouldn't have happened anyway.
What are some examples of either wars that have been waged on that excuse or opportunities that there were to look for genocides and other evils, but that weren't good justifications for wars and so didn't get the attention?
Yes, exactly. Of course, two wars that immediately come to mind was the war, the Kosovo War, which was sold to the public as necessary to prevent genocide in Kosovo. And during that war, there were all kinds of wild statements by the NATO spokespeople about how many people were being killed. After the war, in fact, they found that these statements were untrue. But nobody notices that. I mean, the public doesn't notice that. They don't pay any attention. And the result of that war is to turn it over to a bunch of gangsters who happened to be clients of the United States and to build a great big military, U.S. military base on stolen property. And so that was the real purpose of the war, was to grab this land. And then, of course, the other example is this fake genocide in Libya. And I just describe that in some detail of the sources of the false report. And that was used to destroy a country. Now, in the case of Rwanda, where there really was a genocide, the United States stayed out and now pretends that, oh, dear, we didn't notice. But in fact, the Clinton administration, and Clinton is a great friend of Kagame, who was a U.S. prodigy, and by not interfering, they helped Kagame seize power. So, you see, the U.S. decides when there's going to be a genocide and when there isn't, and they just play this to follow their own power interests.
There's another phrase that's being tossed around in the same circles, including by Hillary Clinton lately, which is the responsibility to protect. Again, that sounds like a very good thing. What is it, in fact?
Well, that's something that they've been selling ever since they played that already in Kosovo. And of course, that was the pretext that they were using. That's another way of preventing genocide, responsibility. You get these slogans going, and then you can make it sound very nice. Oh, dear, we should protect people. But in fact, it doesn't protect the people that we end up bombing on the pretext that we're protecting people. I mean, this is absolutely total hypocrisy, and it is not a way to it avoids ever settling any question, because you start off saying, pretending, claiming, with the media going along with you, that people are about to be massacred and we must hurry up and do something, and then you can't do negotiations. All of this is to prevent diplomacy, to prevent negotiations, and just use military force, which is what the United States has so much of.
Looking at the example of Libya, Diana Johnstone, Hillary, as you recount the events around the U.S. attack, U.S.-led attack on Libya, Hillary played a really major role in this case, didn't she?
Well, it seems that. I mean, she's not the only one, because there's that histrionic Frenchman, Bernard de Lévy, who was getting France involved. But, of course, that's a kind of a front, because France doesn't have the military hardware and stuff to do that. They had some bombing runs, and they took part in it. But this was a little bit of what they call leading from behind. The United States actually did most of the dirty work, but it let its allies look like they were leading. It's horrendous, but it seems that in her debate, and this is something that's pointed out by Conor Friedershoff in the Atlantic, it's absolutely scandalous that in her debate the other day, she could use the Libyan war as something to brag about, which, as the author there points out, really proves how ignorant the American people have been kept about what that war was, because it's a total disgrace on every possible level. I mean, I think it's the core of my book. I'm not going to repeat it because, in a sense, it's the heart of my book. But the fact that she can brag about this terrible crime that she committed just really means that the American people have not been informed and they don't know what it's about. And that's what my book can help explain, I think.
Yeah, I think there may be at least some slight awareness that Libya, like Iraq, was not left a democratic paradise after the liberation. Don't you think?
Well, I think they're somewhat aware of that, but there's very little awareness that it wasn't the absolute hell before.
Right.
And so what people don't realize, they will say, oh, it was terrible before, now it's terrible afterwards, but we tried, you know. That's not so. I was in Libya a few years ago for an international conference, and I had interviews with a lot of people, especially jurists. And Gaddafi had nothing to do with that. I really saw a country that, for the region, was amazingly peaceful, prosperous, and that's been completely ruined. And, of course, people in the United States have no idea of that. They just say, oh, Gaddafi is a horrible dictator, blah, blah, blah. They don't know anything about it, but they accept the media version.
We're speaking with Diana Johnstone, whose new book is Queen of Chaos, The Misadventures of Hillary Clinton. There are some other incidents in Hillary's past, Diana, that I think there isn't really any way for the public to imagine in a good light. For example, coups in Honduras and Ukraine, which you deal with in your book. What happened in Honduras, and what was Hillary Clinton's role?
Well, I start out with that because that's one of her first misadventures. That's the subtitle, by the way, that the editors, the publishers put on the book, because I think misadventures is a very understated term.
Yes.
Well, what she's been up to. But anyway, this was her first role in regime change, in overthrowing the elected president of Honduras. And this was not as bloody as her later exploits, but it shows exactly where she stands socially and politically, and that is she stands with the oligarchies, whether in Honduras or in the United States or anywhere else, against any kind of decency for ordinary people. And her role, she played a clever role, which she also she always has a term for her deceit and hypocrisy, which is smart power. And so she used her smart power to deceive and cheat and help facilitate this military coup, which only plunged Honduras into a worse state than it was already in.
And what is the evidence of her role in that?
Well, it's in her own book. I mean, her book, Hog Power, she really brags about this. So, you see, that's the amazing thing. She not only does these horrible things, but she finds ways to sort of boast about how clever she was.
And what about Ukraine, where I think the U.S. public is avoiding having to put the facilitation of a coup into a good light by maintaining the understanding that nothing happened, there was a nonviolent democratic revolution, and then Ukraine was invaded and attacked by Russia. What's the...
Well, that's another of these political fairy tales. Of course, Hillary was not directly involved, but her former spokeswoman, Victoria Nuland, they're the same breed, they're the same mud. They worked very closely together in destroying Libya, and Victoria Nuland was right on hand to push for and facilitate this coup in Ukraine, which has ended up with a government which has several foreigners, including which is totally run by Americans now, and to help the son of Joe Biden with his business affairs, which are quite considerable there, and other American companies. But I think that is a secondary aspect of this American takeover of Ukraine. The main aspect is being to try to get it into NATO or to use the crisis that the U.S. created in order to build up NATO forces in neighboring states and pretending that Russia is a terrible threat and so we have to build up NATO. This is great for the military-industrial complex. They absolutely have to have such a threat.
And what about just going back to Kosovo and Yugoslavia, which you brought up? Hillary Clinton was not then an office holder, but she was the first lady. What was her role in pushing for war back then?
Well, she bragged to her worshipful biographer that she urged Bill Clinton to bomb. Is that true or is it not true? But the point again is, you see that she is very upfront, in fact, very exhibitionist about how much she likes bombing and war. And that is the first example of that. But she actually boasts about the fact that she urged bombing campaign, which has only produced another disaster. Not as spectacular as the disasters in Iraq, Syria, and Libya, but disastrous in the smaller way, nevertheless.
In the first debate among the Democratic presidential candidates this year, Hillary listed enemies she's proud of having made, and she included in there the Iranians. She has, as far as I know, a record of doing anything the Israeli government wants. What is her position on Israel and Iran, and what is the danger? She famously said that if Iran were to attack Israel, she would obliterate Iran. Is there actually a danger of her pursuing war here?
Well, first of all, I would just remark something that Carl Bernstein brought up in his biography of Hillary, is that she operates by focusing on enemies. It's something in her psychology, apparently, that she likes to focus on an enemy that she can defeat. And this is extremely dangerous for someone who wants to be president, to actually be proud of making enemies. But, of course, when it comes to the Middle East, the enemies that she happens to choose all happen to be enemies of Israel, by some funny coincidence, inasmuch as that big, I keep thinking of Adelson, but it's the other one, big Israeli billionaire who has said that he would put up as much money as necessary to get Hillary elected, the Sabin is his name, and he has said and boasted that he would put up as much money as is necessary to have Hillary elected, because his issue, he's a one-issue person, and his issue is Israel. So it's very clear that Hillary has positioned herself to be the favorite candidate of billionaires who are ready to contribute to campaigns in order to have a president that will do exactly what Israel wants, which will put her right in harmony with the U.S. Congress, by the way, which is extremely dangerous.
The company running that first debate, CNN's parent company, is a big contributor to Hillary. Wall Street is full of big contributors to Hillary. There seems to be quite a surge among the powerful in the United States to support her. How does she compare to some of the other candidates?
Well, I'm not going to get into that, really, because, I mean, comparing to the other candidates, I didn't write this book on behalf of any rival candidate. That's not the purpose of the book. And, in fact, I rather conclude in a rather depressing view that the problem with Hillary is that she reflects the war party, which is in control of the United States for quite a while, and that it takes quite a movement to change that. It isn't just enough to elect someone who says, oh, I'm nice and I'm going to change things, because you have that war party has its grip, and people didn't realize it with Obama, for instance. They thought that was change. It turned out there wasn't any change. So, you know, just a candidate and a president is essentially a salesperson for a policy that is decided by a more permanent thread of control of government than the president, who's sort of a salesperson for the policy. And I just think Hillary would be a particularly eager and enthusiastic salesperson for the war policy that the war party wants to run. And that's why she gets so much support. And the real problem is not just to bring in somebody else. It would be every bit as bad. For instance, Joe Biden is perhaps, well, worse. It's just that he's much dumber than she is. But I don't want to get into the question. I hope that a candidate will emerge who is really a peace party candidate with really important popular support, because that's the only thing. It really takes practically a revolt of the American people who could wake up and say, hey, we don't want to be part of this policy which is destroying one country after another, and it's going to end up coming back on us. And it takes that awareness to make a difference.
Well, I think that is very well said, but I think, as you indicate, that who's president does make some minimal amount of difference, at least, and Hillary is at the very least not better, not preferable to any of the other ones I've seen yet.
No, she she has actually said that she's worse. I mean, she's made it clear that she's worse than Obama because she was more gung-ho for this totally failed policy of training and arming the third force in Syria. I mean, that's the old term for the new thing. Now it's the good rebels. And that's a total flop, that, but she was the big spokesman for that. And Obama hesitated. You see, I don't think she would hesitate as much as Obama had.
And this is where Syria is where the United States and Russia have now been brought more into actual conflict than in Ukraine. And those searching for justifications for military buildup around Russia may have found it now in Syria.
Well, I see some of the statements that are made by certain hopefully irresponsible people about but not that irresponsible. I mean, they're talking about having nuclear arms maneuvers up in north eastern Europe against to prepare for nuclear war against Russia. I think there's a bunch of mad people. I mean, it seems to me that insanity has got into the water in Washington or London or something.
I think it has been growing for some years, as you know. I wonder about levels of corruption and dishonesty, though, because Hillary Clinton seems to me particularly corrupt. I mean, this is someone who doesn't just openly push for more wars, and if you want more wars, vote for her. But this is someone who, as Secretary of State, waived restrictions on shipping and selling weapons to particularly brutal governments after they made contributions to her personal foundation. With that, I mean, can you top that level of corruption? Could there be anything in her emails that could possibly come out that would be worse than what's already openly there?
Well, you know, the corruption, somehow or other, economic, I don't care much about money. It's a subject that I just sort of can't focus on. And I can't focus on her financial dealings either. But I can, the corruption, I'm sure that corruption is there, but the corruption that interests me is her intellectual corruption. And that's really the subject of my book. Her intellectual corruption allows her to talk about human rights and LGBT and all that at the same time of being very, very close to Saudi Arabia, of all places. And, I mean, this is a level of corruption that is much deeper than just grabbing dollars.
That is that she believes in what she's doing. She has an ideology justifying her behavior to herself.
Yes, absolutely. And that's very frightening.
It was on display as well, I think, in her statements about whistleblowers such as Edward Snowden, which was in sharp contrast to some other people. What is her attitude toward secrecy and open democracy?
Well, of course, the secrecy that she wants is the secrecy of the government intelligence agencies, but she doesn't care about the secrecy that ordinary people cherish of their personal lives. She has no concern about the security and privacy, which is a protection, because when a massive security state knows things about everybody, they have the, I mean, somebody in there, I'm not saying they as a whole, but somebody in there has the power and the possibility to frame people that are dissidents, to use that power against people who have done nothing wrong, but if you know where they were and what they did and all of that, this is something that the American people, I think, are very innocent about, and they don't realize how powers can frame people and create false incidents and all of that. I discuss that in the book, but I think a lot of the public is very naive about the uses of this power.
I think President Obama has gotten away with a greater crackdown on whistleblowers and transparency than we had seen in recent years and decades, without much pushback, perhaps because he's a Democrat, not a Republican, and Hillary Clinton seems inclined in that direction. Barack Obama has invented this new kind of war, drone wars, killing people with missiles from drones in huge numbers. And Hillary Clinton seems inclined in that direction. We see her laughing and giggling about killing Gaddafi. She seems to enjoy it, as just as Obama has been quoted as saying that he's, you know, proud at being good at killing people. Is that the direction that Hillary Clinton would go? And if so, is that because of her personality, her ideology, or because of who's funding her?
Well, it's a little of all of that. And the thing since I live in Europe, the thing that I find particularly distressing is that all of this is quite comprehensible to people living outside the United States. But the European leaders are not standing up to this because I think they're just terrified. The U.S. has shown the kind of retaliation that it can take against its allies. Remember the Freedom Fries incident when France dared not to go along with the invasion of Iraq, and then they're demonized, and then the U.S. has this extraterritorial power of deciding that it will fine banks like $8 billion to this BNP bank in France simply because they did dollar business with countries that the U.S. is boycotting. But this was no violation of French law. So that the U.S. is using this power to intimidate the whole world, it's a terrorist power on all kinds of levels. And Hillary just seems to delight in this.
The leader of the largest party in the United Kingdom now, peace activist Jeremy Corbyn, has said he would get out of NATO, he would get U.S. nuclear submarines out of the United Kingdom, and so forth. There seem to be some individuals and parties in Europe with a little bit of spine in this regard, aren't there?
Well, yes, I think this will have to develop simply because it's getting too dangerous for Europe. This huge influx of refugees, migrants, you don't know who they are. Hundreds of thousands and soon to be millions of people coming in. That is can completely destabilize European societies, which are in a state of unemployment already. They can't handle that, and that's a direct result of U.S. wars in the Middle East and Libya. Direct result. I think that's beginning to wake up people on the continent that, my God, we can't keep going on to the U.S. because it's the Pied Piper. They're going to lead us right off the cliff. Corbyn is a breath of fresh air. He's great. The problem is, so far, he hasn't. The Labour people and his party that are in the Parliament don't necessarily agree with him. But he's the start of something, and he is the best news he's had.
Well, I hope you keep waking them up. The book is Queen of Chaos, The Misadventures of Hillary Clinton. Diana Johnstone, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersnap.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, many people were outraged by video evidence of a police officer violently assaulting and arresting a young black woman, not just by the brutality of the attack on a person who posed no threat, but because of where it happened, in a high school classroom. The incident at Spring Valley High School in South Carolina reflects a lot of problems, from the school-to-prison pipeline to the marginalization of black girls and women from conversations about state violence. We'll talk about it with UCLA and Columbia Law Professor Kimberly Crenshaw of the African American Policy Forum, producers of the report Black Girls Matter, Pushed Out, Over-Policed, and Underprotected. Also on the show, a New York Times headline referred to the dueling narratives of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Such language implies a symmetry of power that doesn't exist. We'll discuss what's missing from coverage of the most recent violence in the region with political analyst and writer Youssef Munayer, executive director of the coalition U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press. Donald Trump has claimed many, many times on TV, at campaign stops, and at candidate debates that he opposed the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq in real time. Quote, "I was the one, and I said it very strongly, and you know this. It was reported by everybody because, unfortunately, I get a disproportionate amount of publicity," close quote. That's Trump talking to CNN's Chris Cuomo. At the September debate, he said he could point to 25 different stories about him being against the war before it started. Funny, then, that when Huffington Post's Michael Calderon looked into it, he couldn't find any. Trump's go-to evidence of his being the only GOP candidate who, in his words, had the vision to say that the war was a bad idea is a Reuters piece from July 2004. And while some folks pointed out during the debate that that was 16 months after the war began, Calderon notes that TV interviewers like Meet the Press's Chuck Todd have been too delicate or something to point that out. CNN's Anderson Cooper, for example, had no questions about Trump's statement, quote, "In 2004, I was totally against going in," close quote. And fact-checkers at USA Today raised no eyebrows at the op-ed in which Trump wrote, quote, "I was against the war from the very beginning, all the way back in 2004," close quote. "I didn't want to go into Iraq in 2004, and we went there," he told Joe Scarborough, and so on. It's not that Trump is wrong that the Iraq war was a disaster, and he was quoted calling it a mess about a week after it started. But to let slide again and again his reference to comments in July 2004, at which point even the New Republic opposed the war, is just a press fail. Tamar Haspel is a food columnist for The Washington Post, but it's not her only gig. She also speaks at public events on food issues, many of them produced by agrochemical industry groups. As Stacy Malkin of the group U.S. Right to Know writes for Fair.org, Haspel doesn't think much of anyone who questions whether that might be a conflict. Asked by Malkin's colleague Gary Ruskin how much money she's taken from the agrochemical industry and its front groups, Haspel responded, quote, "Since any group believing biotech has something to offer is a front group, plenty," close quote. She had previously criticized Ruskin for digging into ties between agrochemical companies, their PR firms, and academics at public universities, tweeting, quote, "The money, time, brain power wasted on Gary Ruskin's mean-spirited, self-interested attack on Kevin Falta Can we move on to something useful? Close quote. Well, not everyone thought that that digging was a waste. It prompted a front-page New York Times story and a debate on links between industry groups and professors in the promotion of genetically engineered foods. The University of Florida professor, Kevin Fulta, she refers to, was found to have received an undisclosed grant from Monsanto and to have promised the company, quote, a solid return on the investment, close quote, even while publicly claiming he had no connection to the company. Haspel takes part in things like the Biotechnology Literacy Project, which defined its work as raising the quality of public discourse on GMOs because, quote, fears that our natural food supply is at risk and public health hangs in the balance proliferate. Anti-technology skeptics and dedicated opponents of crop and animal biotechnology abound, close quote. Haspel's editor at the Post sees no problem. Says Joe Yonan, quote, Tamar's not a beat reporter covering agriculture. She's a columnist, and therefore the result is more pointed and even opinionated, close quote. Well, yes, and her opinion is clear in columns like the one on Monsanto's Roundup that concluded that, quote, the most destructive consequence of herbicide tolerance, though, is consumer hostility in a conversation about GMOs that is dominated by that trait, close quote. So what about the Post adding another food columnist who could be opinionated from the perspective of consumers and the public interest? Nah, says Yonan, quote, I believe that Tamar's column does serve the public interest, so I don't feel the need for another columnist, close quote. And finally, credit goes to USA Today for an eye-opening, data-driven series on high-speed police chases. The paper's Thomas Frank reports that more than 5,000 bystanders and passengers have been killed in police car chases since 1979, and tens of thousands injured when officers pursue drivers at high speeds and in hazardous conditions. That's nearly a death a day. He cites infuriating instances like the 60-year-old man killed by a driver police chased down a crowded street because his headlights were off. The paper collected and crunched numbers, examined federal regulations and regional variations. One piece exposed an FBI undercount of police deaths in such chases. The paper's analysis found more than 15 times the number of chase-related deaths that the FBI counts, and the series explored possible solutions. So, while many, if not most, stories are just repurposed press releases or recitations of something someone powerful said, USA Today's series digs up new information that shines a light on an area that powerful entities don't seem to care much about, but should. Wish there were more like it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Condemnation came quickly when video surfaced on social media of a South Carolina police officer assaulting a female high school student in class, in the process of arresting her for, according to reports, either not participating or refusing to put away a cell phone. But while demands to fire school resource officer Ben Fields, who had a history of racialized brutality, were answered, we still haven't had a deep-going conversation about why he was in the room in the first place. The incident at Spring Valley High School is sadly reflective, too, of ways that Black women and girls in particular encounter state violence on a daily basis. That's the problem explored in the report Black Girls Matter, Pushed Out, Over-Policed, and Underprotected, produced by the African American Policy Forum, on whose board I serve. And we're joined now by the group's founder, Kimberly Crenshaw. She's professor of law at UCLA and Columbia Law School, where she also directs the Center for Intersectionality and Social Policy Studies. Welcome back to Counterspin, Kimberly Crenshaw.
It's always a pleasure, Janine. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's welcome news that Ben Fields has been fired, but what doesn't firing this guy do? What's left untouched?
What's left untouched is the entire system that has produced a particularly egregious outcome for the two girls that were involved. We did spend a lot of time over the last 48 hours talking about what should happen to the police officer. And somewhat under the radar was the question of what should happen to the girls. Like, you know, some people kind of assume that once it was decided that the officer acted out of policy, that somehow that would automatically lead to a decision that the charges against the girls should be dropped. But to our knowledge, the charges are still pending. And I think we saw in the statement of the sheriff who fired Mr. Fields that he actually saw the arrest as being legitimate. So we have to now look deeper into how it is possible that one could be subject to arrest either for not paying attention, for looking at a cell phone, or speaking up against brutality that's playing out in the classroom. So the big issue is, can we get to the criminalization of ordinary behavior that young people engage in?
Well, there's so many heartbreaking parts of this. The comment from Nia Kenny, the young woman who recorded the assault and who spoke up and who was then, as you say, arrested herself. She said she did so in part because she knew her classmate didn't have nobody, you know, that her mother and grandmother had died. It just speaks to the multiple levels of trauma in the lives of these girls. And then school was not a haven from that trauma, but an extension of it, you know. So we should remember that the trauma of an incident like this doesn't affect only the immediate victim, but also everyone who witnesses it, and then also everyone who recognizes that they too could be subject to it and that it would somehow be okay, you know.
Yes. And that's the piece of what we were learning when we did our report, Black Girls Matter. There's trauma all around, trauma in being in an institution in which any moment you might be subject to severe punishment, including suspension or, in this case, arrest. There's trauma that many young people, and particularly girls, actually carry into the school with them. So as I was looking at the video, I had no idea what this young lady was dealing with, but it occurred to me that she could well be suffering from some kind of personal challenge, some kind of personal trauma, in which just getting to school is in and of itself a victory, right? If that teacher had simply perhaps approached the young lady or just let her be for a period of time, no doubt the fact that she was suffering from some challenges would have eventually made itself known. But the moment this becomes a law enforcement issue, that becomes the moment where the student's future is placed at risk. And that means our institutions are underserving students, not only by making such behavior subject to law enforcement, but depriving them of the resources that they might otherwise need to handle some of the problems that they're dealing with.
Yeah, Sheriff Lott at every turn says that the young lady was disruptive and disrespectful. It reflects an attitude that the young women and girls who you spoke with for Black Girls Matter, they remarked on that a lot, didn't they? This idea that they were disrespectful, that they were somehow in and of themselves disruptive. That's kind of common.
We were trying to figure out what was behind the disparity. We had found that Black girls are 6 times more likely to be suspended than white girls. And in New York, it was 10 times more likely. But we wanted to know what the stories behind the data were. And girls would tell us that they felt strongly that the teachers and administrators looked at them as problems. They said they see us as loud, unruly. The girls use the word ghetto. They see us as ghetto when we participate in class. Sometimes the way that we participate or the way that we talk, the teachers don't like, or they'll see it as being disrespectful. And when they get disrespected, the responses often will leave the classroom.
Yeah, Brittany Cooper in Salon was saying, you know, one girl was being punished for being quiet and another girl was being punished for speaking up, you know. It's a textbook illustration, if we needed one, of the school to prison pipeline. You know, these girls could now have records, you know, what people call push out from schools, this kind of thing that basically lessens young women's interest in going to school, makes it harder for them to be there. That then leads to many other things. That then has far greater repercussion even outside of school, doesn't it?
Not only are Black girls disproportionately facing push out, but the consequences of that push out include both being caught up in the school-to-prison pipeline, being arrested for things that teenagers do all the time, and teenagers do in non-zero-tolerance schools without fear of arrest. But also, we know that any time a girl is separated from school, it increases the risk that she won't graduate. It increases the risk that she will encounter other kind of risks when she's not in school. But then beyond that, not being able to graduate and graduate on time is associated with long-term insecurity, both economically in terms of access to the workforce, housing insecurity, and greater risk of being caught up in the criminal justice system.
Well, let me just ask you finally, how do we move forward from this? What are some things that we can be doing or demanding right now with regard to this?
Well, one thing I definitely hope happens is that the frame stays open. Now that we've seen this, we can no longer go back to the assumption that police violence, both in and out of the school, really only impacts men and men of color in particular. The second thing is hopefully this will create finally a moment to have a very serious conversation about whether police belong in schools at all. I often think about the fact that my own mother taught junior high school for 50 years, and she was known as a disciplinarian. She never had to rely on sworn officers to come in and do her job. So it may be that our current teachers who have relied on the police to actually enforce classroom discipline have got to learn new skills. If that's the case, then let's make that happen. But this reliance on the police cannot be consistent with what we want to happen in our public schools.
We've been speaking with Professor Kimberly Crenshaw. You can find the Black Girls Matter report, along with more work, at the African American Policy Forum website. That's aapf.org. Kimberly Crenshaw, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Always a pleasure, Janine. Thanks.
You hear a lot in the U.S. media about a clash of narratives in the fighting between Palestinians and Israelis. But the truth is, U.S. news is shaped much more by one perspective than the other. Israeli deaths are foregrounded, with those of Palestinians often appearing as a dependent clause, even though they are far greater. Claims by Israeli authorities are presented matter-of-factly, even when they are disputed. And the overall image is of a battle between symmetrical forces, even when one is armed with knives and rocks and the other with one of the most powerful militaries in the world. It's a presentation that is more skewed in some ways than that presented in Israeli media, and it poorly serves those hoping to make sense of the situation or to envision possible ways forward. So what should we keep in mind as we read about what's called the latest round of violence in Israel-Palestine, including fights over holy sites in Jerusalem? Joining us now to discuss the issues is Youssef Mouner. He's executive director of the coalition U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. Youssef Mouner, welcome back to Counterspin.
Great to be back.
Well, U.S. media tend to treat the conflict between Israel and Palestine as just, which side are you on? You know, Israelis say and believe this, Palestinians say and believe that. But it ought to be a reportable story. And it is possible to deplore knife attacks by Palestinians, for example, and still demand that these be presented in a broader context. What would that broader context on the most recent events include?
I think one of the biggest challenges really is the schedule, if you will, on which this issue is covered. The moments when that happens is almost always when Israelis are exposed to greater degrees of violence. The problem with this, of course, is that it creates a frame of understanding in the mind of the American news consumer that these events happen in something of a vacuum. What's missing is what happens in between and always, and that is the status quo of military military occupation, which is itself a system of violence, a system that holds Palestinians, that holds human beings in a condition that is contrary to the natural human condition of freedom, and uses force, uses violence to keep them in that position. So this systematic violence, which Palestinians are essentially acting out against in these outbursts, which eventually get covered, does not get covered the way that it should. And so what we end up getting is a very skewed representation in our media of what the real dynamics of violence are.
Someone noted that a recent USA Today story mentioned the occupation in its lead, in its first paragraph, which is something actually quite rare. Often the story zooms in on whatever the most recent clash was, and the occupation, if it gets in there, is kind of at the end, you know, as part of a list of other things going on, when in fact that is a crucial context in any story one would think of violence.
Absolutely, and just because violence against Israelis stops for any period of time, the occupation doesn't stop. It remains consistent. The violence of the occupation remains consistent, and this is the context in which all of this is occurring. And unfortunately, in the coverage that we often see, this incident-based coverage, even the reporting of those incidents is highly skewed and very much a representation of official Israeli narratives. And we see this time after time when you have any of these incidents with things as simple as a physical altercation, a stabbing, an attack on one group of people or a family, for example. Well, who has access to the information of what takes place in this situation? Primarily, it's the Israeli military, and it's the Israeli military that gets to decide what information to release. And if you are a Western reporter, you are beholden to the information that the Israeli military releases. So they get to set the terms of what actually took place, unless, of course, the Western reporters take the initiative to actually go and investigate on the scene of these events, talk to witnesses that were there, talk to Palestinians who experienced what's going on, and report as well that perspective on the events that took place. And more often than not, we only see a regurgitation of the official Israeli narrative in the vast majority of these events.
Well, I'm looking at an AP story from today, from October 29th. The headline is "Palestinians Killed in West Bank in Stabbing Incidents." As you read the piece, you learn that police said one of the Palestinians killed had stabbed a soldier, wounding him lightly, and that the military said the other person had attempted to stab a soldier, but a Palestinian witness disputes that. Now, there you see at work not just the reliance on the Israeli police and the military for the information, but there also doesn't seem to be any questioning of the idea that the penalty for stabbing or maybe attempting to stab someone is summary execution. Have reporters just become so inured to that that they leave it unchallenged?
It certainly seems that way. And, of course, that's what we've seen in terms of the response from the Israeli security apparatus, whether it's the police or the military, in response to some of these incidents. And in many cases, what happens is a Palestinian is shot and killed even at a time when they are not presenting any threat, when non-lethal force could be used to arrest them. And we've seen some of these incidents caught on video as well. We've also seen incidents where Palestinians who have already been subdued are then fired into additional times and essentially executed. This is, of course, very troubling, not only because it is an illegal extrajudicial assassination, but also because it speaks to the message that the Israeli government is trying to send to Palestinians, and it speaks to how they believe this problem is going to be solved. That only through the use of brute force, that only through the expression that any resistance will be met with the strongest possible repression will Palestinians get the message that this has to stop. Unfortunately, what we've seen is that the entrenchment of the occupation, the continuance of these policies, is only likely to continue to stoke the ire of Palestinians living under these oppressive systems.
Well, let me continue on that idea of what sends a message. A few weeks back, lots of folks thought that it was bizarre that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu would claim that a Palestinian gave Hitler the idea of the Holocaust. But in a recent piece for The Nation, you say that outlandish claims like that actually also have a kind of message delivery purpose. Tell us a little about that.
Sure. Well, you know, what the Israeli Prime Minister did in essentially saying that Hitler didn't intend to exterminate the Jews until a Palestinian gave him the idea is problematic on so many levels, especially coming from an Israeli Prime Minister and the representative of the state which has often really condemned Holocaust revisionism. But it's part of something bigger as well. It's part of this attempt that Netanyahu has often made, and many others as well have made, to suggest that the reason that Palestinians behave the way that they do toward Israelis is because of a deep-seated, innate hatred of Jews, not because of the experience that they've had living under the jackboot of military occupation, not because of the experience of dispossession that took place when the State of Israel was created, when hundreds of thousands of refugees were forced from their homes, not because of any of that. Rather, what they want people to believe is that Palestinians, by virtue of who they are opposed to Jews. And the reason that they argue this is because they would like to continue policies of brute force. It's obviously a very racist analysis, an analysis that's very wrong as well, but it is a politically convenient analysis for those who do not want to end the military occupation, who do not want to come to a just and lasting peace agreement with Palestinians who, whether they like it or not, are going to be living on that land with Israelis for as long as time will allow. You know, I think it's a very dangerous narrative that the Israeli Prime Minister and many others are engaging in as well.
We've been speaking with Youssef Mouner. He's of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. You can find them online at endtheoccupation.org. Youssef Mouner, thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
You're very welcome.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Say, would you like a persistent source of short videos of hope, where people like you generate abundant food, just working with nature rather than against her? All you have to do is get on Jeff Lawton's mailing list. He's turned me on to permaculture doers who have ended up as guests on Radio EcoShock. After writing many books on permaculture and teaching literally thousands of students, Lawton is among the few who have designed and guided major eco-restoration projects in many countries, including at the request of governments. So it's fitting that, despite a belief in non-hierarchical networking, Jeff Lawton gave a first keynote speech at the 15th Annual International Permaculture Convergence, held in mid-September 2015 in London. It was inspiring. Here is that talk.
It's great to be here presenting in my home country. I was born in Stoke-on-Trent in Staffordshire in 1954. My parents moved to Bournemouth in 1956, where I went to school and grew up fishing the Stour and the Avon and the Hampshire and Dorset coasts. And I love that coastline. And studying the forest ecology, especially the New Forest in Hampshire and its commons, which I feel privileged to have visited in the last few days. I moved to North Devon in 1974 and started surfing and winter travelling almost out of necessity as an English surfer. That led me to Australia in 1979. And it was in that first year I came across permaculture. And I've become more involved every year since. And now, in 2015, I'll be 61 this year. And I'm pretty sure it's a terminal infection. I don't think I'm going to recover. If we look around at our planet through the eyes of an intelligent visitor from another world and assess the Earth's biggest challenges, the most obvious would be the problems created by the human population, yeah? I think probably 99.9% of the activity seems to be fueled by kind of self-interest, competitive greed, non-cooperation, exploitation of people and resources, and maybe with just 1%, you think there's 1% of positive patterned action facilitating productive ecosystems and abundance? Maybe 0.01%. I don't know. Have we got 7 million who've heard the word permaculture yet? Because it's the other 99% or 99.9% who are the real audience. So our existence, the human race has been responsible for creating tremendously harmful imbalances impacting both living and non-living systems of the Earth. Our planet is currently suffering unparalleled rates of species extinction and biodiversity losses. These problems are symptoms and large indicators of really major evil in action. Ecosystems on a worldwide scale and are unable to endure the continuous negative human forces. Our major climate stabilizers, they are. They're collapsing across the world, across the Earth. They're collapsing. They're our stabilizers. These life-rich systems are the shock absorbers. Like the shock absorbers in your car take out the vicious bounces. They allow for points of balance to be restored after massive fluctuations in energy, such as hurricanes and cyclones and other natural catastrophe. Without them, our own existence comes into question as well. Energy systems can also be thought of as energy stores, energy storage systems, with expressions of full diversity from the top predator to the mass life weight diversity expressed in soil organisms, where most of the life weight is, with soil creation as a consequence and an indicator of energy charge capacity. Energy being constant, quote Einstein, As we simplify and destroy global ecosystems, our climate becomes more energetic, yeah? The energy has to go somewhere. The variations in our global climate extremes are more volatile every year and exponentially increasing. In every region of the world, we're experiencing record-breaking extremes in all directions, simultaneously reaching the upper limits of one system and the barest bounds of another. The hottest, the coldest, the biggest drought, the biggest floods, the biggest winds, everywhere worldwide at the same time. This doesn't have to be the reality we live in. We know the attitude, we know the approach, and the science which can cure all that ails us. After 25 years of designing, teaching, consulting on every continent throughout the world, I feel the solution is very obvious. With permaculture design, we can not only impede our current negative effect, we can reverse it into a positive one. With the potent potential of permaculture, like an infectious global pandemic, we have to infect people, so they are infectious. All we have to do is hone in and pay close attention to the natural systems. Through our enhanced observation skills, anyone can see the very obvious cause and effect reactions in all biological systems. Using both climatic moderation and ecosystem species richness as gauges, positive feedback loops intensify beneficial effects. These are what both people and the environment need. Positive feedback loops intensifying beneficial effects. A massive increase in positive feedback loops. Permaculture specializes in this field, finding beneficial interactions between elements and creating as many of these connections as possible. We need an evolution of the way we think. It's now recorded neural science, the new neural pathways where we can see one synapse in the brain fire with the ultrasound accuracy that we now have, that it's believed that we actually grew a slightly bigger brain at the point where we started to read and write and describe the world in actual writing with numbers and letters and words. There was an evolution in our brains. I think that's what we do to people when we teach them permaculture. We put that final shine on that neural cortex. The outer brain gets just a fraction bigger. That last fractal, that design mind evolution. I get worried about what we do to students. It concerns me. I feel responsible. And I've lost 4 in the field on aid work. They died for this. So it's pretty serious. The approach of permaculture design can solve all of the global challenges bearing down on our strained biosphere. Our initial action should be to stabilize our systems. Only then can we, and we absolutely without a doubt can do this, convert these systems into reliable, consistent and permanent resources possessing true and useful value. The problem is the solution. Every problem is a potential opportunity. It's up to us to change our perceptions. It's up to us to allow for unlimited abundance and positivity. With our vision of the emerging future, we can all achieve together. It starts with ethics. It's about ethics. It's about design. And it is about science. We're an ethical design science. First and foremost, we must engage with our current water management and access crisis. Water is essential to life systems. Our first speaker spoke about that quite well, and the history of the snowball Earth and our water events. We look for it on other planets because it's the chief indicator for a world's ability to conceive and sustain complex life forms. When we look at another planet, if there's a chance there's water there, there's a chance there's life there. That's how we look at the universe. Personally, I've been fascinated by water all my life. I've been intensely engaged in all aspects in all its aspects, from small-scale harvesting systems built by hand to immense landscapes built with enormous earth-moving machines. I have an in-depth understanding and a long-lasting expertise with aquatic dynamics and their crucial role in building life-rich systems. In the extreme climates and landscapes, water is the priority in design. Yet, clean drinking water is becoming extremely rare in the natural world and is now becoming only a manufactured product in most locations. That's pretty sad. The World Health Organization reports that more than 750 million people lack access to clean drinking water. So how clever are we? Diarrhea caused by inadequate drinking water, sanitation and hand hygiene kills an estimated 842,000 people every year globally. That's approximately 2,300 people that are going to die today and every day. Irrigation water is also in more demand all the time, ridiculously in more demand all the time. Industrial agriculture is increasing the world's dependency on irrigation technology. That's clever, eh? Due to its ever-growing thoughtless actions without regard to the holistic integration of natural systems. We're just going to go the technical route towards irrigation technology. The signs of water strain globally are the flood and drought regimes, which are increasing. And rising in frequency, and more importantly, in high-end variability. By implementing permaculture design and constructing productive ecosystems that are sensitive and aligned with holistic integrations of natural systems, we can reverse this effect. To appropriately design life-rich systems that harvest, pacify, and allow access to ample clean water, all while providing for our needs, is the ultimate indicator of our ability and intelligence. That simple H2O. We have an obligation and a responsibility to achieve this as an evolutionary process. As a species, I know we've found the holistically designed science system capable of this feat. Permaculture is the vehicle of our evolution. Water has so many constants. Of all the elements on Earth, water has probably the most constants in the way it behaves. And by patterning water the right way, we can be the most productive. It is the most productive element. The most production comes from water itself in protein and plant material and mass growth. The most productive plants, the most productive protein, the most productive forage. They're all water. Water defies gravity somewhat. First water, the mantra of a designer. First water, then access, then structural positions, before anything else. The other large-scale challenge created by industrial agriculture is soil depletion. Industrial agriculture is degrading and destroying soil fertility and physically eroding soils on a global scale at permanent loss rate faster than ever before in history. Soil is the core of sustainability. It's the ultimate physical indicator that a practical system is sustainable. If you're not creating soil, or at least not destroying soil, which is pretty hard to stay on that line, you may as well be creating more soil in quality and quantity, then you are sustainable. Nothing else gives you that indicator, nothing. A sustainable system produces more energy than it consumes and enough in surplus to maintain and replace its component parts over their lifetimes. End of story. That is sustainable systems. You don't need to waffle on about it. By measuring and improving soil quality while creating new soil with appropriate interactions, we can begin the journey towards soil abundance. Soil is the most complex living system in the known universe. It deserves our appreciation and respect. Agriculture in its present form does not stand the test of time. It's a very bad idea, actually. It's a very bad idea to develop and structure any system to be
eternally reliant upon finite resources. It's just basic mathematics. Our biggest mistake in history has been to try and provide our needs from living elements without taking the responsibility of paying serious attention to the changing effects they have on the natural world. I've just visited a few sites and filmed a few sites around England. I've seen some amazing work. I visited Graham Bell's property in Coldstream in Scotland, and I was amazed at 800 square metres of absolute abundance in a cold climate on the same latitude as Moscow, with Graham's estimate of 2 tonnes of earthworms in the soil on 800 square metres. There's probably 5 to 10 times as much bacteria, because they have to have bacteria to live on, and there has to be an abundance of them. That's without the fungi interaction, the flagellates and protozoas and nematodes of all beneficial action in the soil. There's probably an equivalent of 200 tonnes of life per acre on that soil. In that soil, we concentrate on feeding the soil, and our crazy system at Zaytuna Farm, which is not a sensible farm whatsoever, it's just a mad experiment research centre that you would never dream of designing in that form as a family farm. It's totally undisciplined and practice ground for people who want to come and make mistakes. We throw compost at the soil at an alarming rate. Every week we put a cubic metre of compost on 150 square metres and repeat that every 20 weeks as we cycle chickens across a garden. It works out to somewhere between 50 to 80 cubic metres an acre minimum, sometimes up to 200 cubic metres an acre. It sort of compensates for everybody's playing around with the place. And of course it's more productive all the time. I've got a better garden than I ever had every year I have. We all should have, shouldn't we? Shouldn't we have a better system every year? If we haven't, why not? I don't think that's very hard. But poverty is the end result of this environmental injustice. Our injustice towards the environment creates poverty. Worldwide hunger is growing, and it's not slowing down. The sad fact is more children go hungry every day. The United Nations estimates that 805 million people of the 7.3 billion people in this world, or 1 in 9, were suffering from chronic undernourishment between 2012 and 2014. 1 in 9 of us, globally, mostly children, undernourished. And the reason is very, very simple. We're not interacting with our planet in a balanced way. The destruction of our basic survival resources is creating perpetual increase in global poverty. While the corporation wealth-funded science and technology profit production and consumption lobby continues to promise a saviour, people are starving to death. So how good are those big universities out there that are massively funded by that corporation technology profit production and consumption lobby? How good are they? What use are they? And it's not GMO that's going to help us. Because what interaction does that have to the environment that's of any benefit? Where's the feedback loop there? It's not letting poison companies control our global food supply, is it? Do you think? Because they do. Poison companies control our global food. They're experts at making poison. Who decided that was a good idea? It's ethical design science in action that will get us out of this mess. The definition of wealth has been manipulated, disfigured, mutated, if you will. We've been led astray. And we've been led astray with the media, social media, multimedia, World Wide Web, weapon. Well, every weapon can be a tool, and we need to turn that tool right around. We need to move the goalposts. We need to alter our aspirations. We need to do this. When we do this, we will achieve true wealth, and not only understanding, but using permaculture design as the directive for positive action. We have, as a birthright, very basic requirements in life that we are entitled to. I feel as an international community, we should make every possible effort to reclaim these basics in order to become truly wealthy. The core requirements of true prosperity are abundance of clean air, an abundance of clean water, and an abundance of clean, nutritious food with these fundamentals in place, we can continue on to create an abundance of sensible, passive, energy-designed housing and low embodied energy, therefore providing for an abundantly supportive community unified in action by permaculture ethics. This will create the ultimate evolution in humanity's potential. The revolution is no longer disguised as gardening, but obviously sedition and permaculture, people power. A meaningful existence fulfills us. We need to progress on from where we are to where we want to be. This in itself is a very meaningful process. With the widespread adoption of permaculture design globally, we will have no need for industrial agriculture in its present intensive form. Conventional chemical as well as organic farming both lack sensitivity for global patterning, appropriate scale, and beneficial positioning of interactive diversity. Industrial agriculture is inherently inefficient, obviously and inevitably unsustainable. We have been passionately teaching people how to rapidly make soil on small scale for many years, with specific techniques and creating local compost. It's very feasible to design productive ecosystems to facilitate the creation of soil over large areas. Mass education is now possible for all. I stand before you as testament to that. All children and adults willing to learn can be completely fluent in this patterned language to a level of understanding that can be expressed in eloquence. I've always been worried about my carbon credits. I was never quite sure whether I should stop flying and stay home and just create the Findorn of permaculture kind of thing. Facebook told me I was wrong. When I signed on to Facebook and friended everybody that wanted to friend me, it kind of went a bit mad. And my advisor said, "You're nuts." And then they made me a public figure and I still kept going. But people kept coming to me saying, "I'm in somewhere crazy because of you and a video and a connection and so, and on and on and on." So many people, I thought, I've paid my carbon credits, thank goodness. I said, I can keep flying. And then I came across a block that had an average of 30 students. I'm never going to be able to teach all the people that I need to teach. And I said, how do I teach 1,000 people in every course or more? I came up with a system where I taught 30 years worth of students in 12 weeks on a face-to-face ratio and got a better result than any face-to-face courses I've ever taught. A better result. I say a better result because the students went into action and produced designs, 20% of them, I could never do in my wildest dreams as long as I live. They're better designs than I can actually do. I've never seen that before. So I did it 3 times. I'm 90 years in front. I just bought 90 years of carbon credits. Let's strive towards positive solutions. It is essential that international permaculture design is adopted as the core of all relevant science. With our ethics at the core as we go into action, then and only then will we engage as a serious effort and effect for all people. We'll start to implement and invest in a completely global extension of true sustainability that will repair the earth and create absolute abundance. The current crisis is actually our ultimate opportunity to evolve as a species. We've been presented with the chance to learn from the transformation we have to make. The path from the negative death and destruction economy rooted in the production and consumption system must begin. We have a duty to advance into the endlessly expansive economy of ecology that will produce a balanced global environment with a stable, plentiful earth for all future generations. There is no limit to richness in natural systems, and the more we engage in permaculture design systems, the more intricate and refined they become. By starting with the core ethics that govern our actions and by allowing the systems that we implement to demonstrate their evolutions, we will inevitably create a world so abundant it will exceed the edges of our present imagination. True wealth will become endlessly available to us. True wealth is achievable by design, and now is the time. Our ethos of taking action is to make sure that we care for the earth, care for each other, and leave a positive legacy for future generations. A complete transformation of humanity's action is possible. We can grow from the most destructive species on Earth and return to our rightful position as the facilitators of Earth's ecological function through permaculture design. Our common goal unifies the global community and is our true inheritance. A return to observing and learning from nature is non-negotiable. From observation, we can take these lessons and turn them into directives for action. With the ethical design framework and its principles inspired by nature and an emphasis on low-cost solutions, we can meet our everyday needs. From Greenland to Australia, from Korea to South Africa, across the globe, we can live in absolute abundance. We can be very optimistic that this can be achieved, as everything we need to know is available to us. There needs to be a global effort to redesign the systems that meet our basic needs along ecological principles. This will dramatically change our fortunes with a realistic prospect of a positive future for all. With 40 years of testing and experimentation, permaculture is ready to scale up. Alhamdulillah.
That was the Australian permaculture author, teacher, and designer, Jeff Lawton. The presentation came at the International Permaculture Convergence in mid-September in London. Check out my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info for links to the 9-hour-long YouTube video of the official conference part of the convergence. And find out more about Jeff at jefflawton.com. Jeff is spelled with a G, and Lawton is Lawton. Next up, Albert Bates interviews the octogenarian permaculture activist, transplanted from Ireland to Germany, Declan Kennedy.
Okay, I'm Albert Bates. We're here with Declan Kennedy, and we're going to talk about permaculture. So could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Declan Kennedy, born and brought up in Dublin, Ireland. And then I was exported, as so many children are, from Ireland. But I went to Germany instead of to other English-speaking countries. And so I've been living now almost 60 years in Germany.
How did you get involved with permaculture?
Through the fact that I was looking for an answer to the inferior quality of life and food in the large city of then West Berlin. And then happened on this man and his student, and they had just put together the first concepts of a permanent agriculture, which was moving towards permanent culture. And I saw that there was not only a concept, but there was a terrific possibility of expanding this, because already I had been working with Doxiadis in Athens on the holistic concept of planning called ecistics, which is ecos, you know, the same, the household, the science of human settlements. And I'm still trying to get the permaculture principles going in human settlements and in urban settlements.
Given what you've experienced over these many years now, are you, and knowing what you might about the climate situation and other threats to humans, mm-hmm. are you hopeful or not?
It sort of oscillates. I sometimes think we're so darn stupid, you know, that we would even get ourselves into this position. And what the hell are we doing with all the fantastic universities and all the fantastic scientists we have? And we're messing up the world more and more as we go along. And then I realized here and there are lots of initiatives of mainly non-scientists, but often then being supported more or less by the science. And they are simple people. They are people who have not lost their values. And that's what happens with this wonderful thing that's supposed to be university here. We lose our values through all sorts of other preoccupations and, you know,
jacking
and that sort of thing. I mean, we've got to a ridiculous situation. But I come to a meeting like this then, and, you know, here am I, over 80, and I'm corresponding with the teenagers and the 20-year-olds better than I'm corresponding with my own age, or even the ones in between, with exceptions, obviously. But I can almost talk to any 20, and they'll have a question and answer. They'll have a discussion. We'll really get into depth. It's just beautiful. So that's my hope. My hope is, in point of fact, there is a sort of an exponential curve going in the collective intelligence. And I think that's what's going to save us. Because we don't have to save the Earth. We have to save ourselves from our stupidity and from our problems. But as we say in permaculture, you know, the problem is the solution. And there is so many solutions there that I can see, if we really got down to it, we could do it very, very quickly. Yeah, maybe before I get to be 100.
Well, I hope to be there then. I'll come to your birthday party. Very good.
That was the German permaculture activist and visionary Declan Kennedy, as interviewed by Albert Bates. Albert is the author of books like The Biochar Solution, Carbon Farming and Climate Change, and The Post-Petroleum Survival Guide and Cookbook, Recipes for Changing Times. He is the host of The Great Change blog at peaksurfer.blogspot.ca. Get all those links in my own show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. We're in our second program about permaculture, climate change, and survival. I'm Alex Smith. Albert's next guest is one of the long-serving leaders and communicators of permaculture in the United Kingdom. For many years, Andrew, or Andy Goldring, has been the coordinator and CEO of the Permaculture Association in Britain. We find out more in this interview by Albert Bates.
Tell me what's your name and where you're from.
Okay, hi Albert. My name's Andy Goldring. I live in Leeds in Yorkshire in the north of England.
Great. And could you tell me a little bit about how the Permaculture Association of the UK got going?
Okay, so the Permaculture Association started in the early 80s. There are a few courses, and I think Max Lindegger came along one day and said, come on guys, it's time to get an association organised. You need to start an organisation. So it started in 93, became a charity in 83, became a charity in 1986, mostly on a very sort of fairly small scale. At the beginning, the Permaculture Association was the network. You know, anybody that knew about permaculture was involved, and it was quite a small, tight huddle. By the early 90s, it had grown quite substantially. The Permaculture Magazine became an independent organisation. That really increased the number of people interested in permaculture. The association had a bit of a dip. When I got involved in 96 as a trustee, we realised we had quite a lot of work to do to really make it work. And then in 99, it moved to Leeds. And really what I realised is that it had been kind of going every 3 years, the next volunteer team had taken over. So there was a bit of lack of continuity. So really the main thing that I've been doing is just being there for the last 16 years. And in the last 16 years, our work has grown really substantially. We've got a thriving diploma system, a great educators network, a land network of 125 demonstration projects. We're nurturing country networks in Scotland and Wales. But the Welsh permaculture network is called Paramaethu Cymru, which literally means perpetually nurturing Wales, which is really wonderful. So we're trying to support local networks to flourish and to become self-organising and self-governing and maintaining. Yeah, and our mission is to enable people across Britain to design sustainable communities and contribute to permaculture worldwide. I think one of the things we've done as part of the international network has been a kind of fairly consistent presence. And we're not trying to lead anything, but we can hold some of the space, basically. So part of our work is around that international development and how we can help to create a more effective and coherent network.
Excellent. So if a fairy godmother suddenly appeared and granted you three wishes, what do you think they would be?
Okay, so I'll be a bit radical. My first wish would be for permaculture designers to become the best economists. We already think of ourselves as ecologists, which is the study of relationships in the household, for oikos, the household. The economists is all about stewardship of resources. So we've got great thinking and great design. Now we need to be really stepping into the actual stewarding of our resources, and that's where we become great economists. The economy is what drives everything. And so for permaculture to step into that space and for us to be good economists is really critical. That's to do our own businesses, but also to support other businesses to move into a more ecological mode. My second wish would be to develop a kind of permaculture commonwealth, a set of common resources, which would mean that any permaculture practitioner anywhere in the world could have access to world-class resources to support them in their work. So that would primarily be educational resources. It might be business templates and patterns. It would be research guides. Much of that already exists. If we could pull that together into an easily accessible commons, and we could work together to keep improving it, then we would all be really well resourced. And we have the pool, the power of the internet now to assemble those materials. So I think a set of common assets that we could share and develop would just give so many people a lift. It would give them so many people access to what they don't have at the moment. So the second wish would be to develop a really coherent and effective set of common resources. And finally, I think we kind of enjoy having these convergences. And I think we need to get really good at them and have them locally, bioregionally, nationally, continentally, and occasionally internationally as well. And in a sense, I think the convergence can evolve into a kind of participatory democracy where the people that are doing this permaculture economy with a common set of resources can get together and decide what their priorities are for action. So it becomes a real living democratic process within which we can look together at what our priorities are for the bioregion or our priorities are for the national permaculture network development and how we can use the resources we've got to make that happen. So obviously national governments will still exist and there'll be all sorts of other organisations out there, but we can govern ourselves well. And I think that's important because governing is about reaching a goal. Governance comes from the kybernoutos, I think it's either the Latin or the Greek, which means steersman. The governor is the steersman that gets the boat to the destination. So our destination is a planet where we care for the Earth, care for each other, and share our resources, live within the Earth's carrying capacity. So it's a big goal. To reach that goal, we've got to work together. And we need to find places where we can, share our priorities, agree our priorities, identify the resources that we've got so we can make them happen. It's a real face-to-face thing. We have to build relationships, but we also need an online space, which is like an ongoing convergence. So I think if we were to use something like, say, in the Sweden and Germany, the Pirate Party that emerged out of those governments wanting to crack down on kind of internet. For example, anyway, the point is that there are online mechanisms which enable a community to start to develop proposals and to give those proposals backing, to make agreements and to direct their resources. So we could have an online convergence every day where we're actually we're stewarding our own resources in a really effective way. And the face-to-face convergences is where we build actually the real human relationships. So my three wishes would be, let's become the best economists, let's create a common pool of resources, and let's govern ourselves in a way that's effective.
Excellent. Okay, so many of us, as we read the headlines in the news, or we talk to our friends, or we hear the scientific discussion, we tend to be going into deeper levels of despair. It's a dark night of the soul.
Absolutely.
The looking at what's happening to the planet and to biodiversity, the climate change, and so on. Do you have hope, and where does it come from?
I do have hope. I have a lot of hope. I have hope every time I walk along the pavement and I see a plant coming through the cracks. It feels to me that permaculture has a really deeply unfair competitive advantage. First of all, we've got the moral high ground because we're doing earth care, people care, fair shares. Hey, that's something that billions of people already believe in. I don't really think of permaculture as a movement. I think of it more as a network which is serving the wider movement. And that wider movement actually contains millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of people. Hundreds of millions, probably billions of people. You know, the Buddhists believe in earth care, people care, fair shares. Well, that's quite a lot of people. You know, and many, many others. So we've got the kind of moral high ground, or at least we've got a very excellent ethical framework which can be widely agreed and shared. But most importantly, we've got the force of nature on our side. We're about working with nature. Now, if we can really genuinely understand how to work with nature, then we've got the energy of the universe at our disposal. I think if we understood how to cooperate with bacteria, we could probably sort climate change out quite quickly. So the natural processes exist to bring the earth back into balance. It's about getting the water systems right, it's about getting the soil systems right, and establishing the vegetation that keeps the water and soil in place. So I think what's interesting is we look at a lot of the exponential growth curves that are going in the wrong direction. They're the wrong curves. You know, population going up crazy in a crazy way, energy use going up, climate change gases going up. Well, what would happen if agroecological design practice or agroecological practice started to follow an exponential curve? What if soil building started to follow the exponential curve? What if permaculture trainers follow an exponential curve? If we bring together all the things that we know are not only possible, but are actually already working, we can do it. So to me, it's a bit like we've had an industrial revolution. Actually, it happened quite fast. The ecological revolution can be faster. And the critical thing is not can we do it from a technical perspective, it's now about organising. If we can organise enough, co-organise our shift to an ecological practice, then I think there's still just about time to stabilise water and soil systems. Because for me, the big hope is in not just how we can improve soil on the managed land of the world. So I've read that if you had something like a 2% increase in soil carbon in just the farmed soils that we already have, that would draw down a huge amount of carbon. So that's exciting. But the other one is that when you look at sort of the really broad scale stuff like the holistic management grazing, when you can start to bring the dry lands back into production. So it feels to me like the soil is really at the heart of the challenge. And what's great about that is that 2 billion people are still occupied in agriculture. If we could empower those people to manage their soil well and to manage their rangelands and their grazing well, then not only could we fix carbon, but we could also improve the lives of the world's poorest people. So so many people have something to gain from working the soil better, restoring our degraded landscapes. So we've got to organise well. We've got to connect up with the campesina, the land workers, the people that are already interested, and then we have to marshal our evidence so we can start to make shifts in the way that some of the bigger companies start to invest their money. And ultimately, we need governments to be on side, but I'm not going to wait for them.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the time you took. And this is a wonderful conference. I want to say that you've done a marvelous job of organizing and getting us all here in good kit now. We're all healthy still and able to go back and do our work afterwards. Thank you so much.
That was Andy Goldring, the head of the Permaculture Association in Britain and a driving force towards a greater international organization and widespread skill and knowledge sharing.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
Albert Bates contributes our last interview, this time with Andrew Millison. He's from Corvallis, Oregon. Let's get this American perspective on the highs from the 15th International Permaculture Convergence in London last September.
My name's Andrew Millison, and I live in Corvallis, Oregon.
Okay, Andrew, why are you here in England?
Well, I came to tap into the global gathering, the global wisdom, sort of dropping into the matrix of permaculture thought. And I've not been disappointed, I must say. It's been quite an experience.
Yeah. Highlights.
Highlights. Okay. there's a number from the conference and from the convergence. I think that Jeff Lawton's talk at the convergence at the conference was really a highlight for me. He kind of took it to this outside perspective of the evolution of humanity and what's happening with the earth and where we're going. That was really deep. Ethan Rowland's talk on regenerative enterprise, he really showed how we could change the supply chains, right? And how that was the pathway to actually regenerating the ecosystems of the earth was through supplying products that were sourced from regenerative projects. Here at the Convergence, there's been a lot of really fun partying and dancing, and that's been awesome. But as far as presentations, Dave Bainline's presentation on the design of the Chaikuni Center down in Peru, that was really exceptional. Some of the conversations we had in the Next Big Step gatherings, I sat on this climate change group with Starhawk and with yourself and a number of other people came in and just really brainstorming on how to tap into our collective networks and momentum to actually create some kind of structure that can flip the consciousness of the planet, especially in this crucial time and when big events happen. You know, how can we turn the tide of humanity towards regenerative systems?
Do you have any practical strategy in that regard?
Well, my suggestion in our meetings was to create a portal that will take people who are looking for climate change solutions and direct them towards permaculture, and especially being able to jump on that media transmission after natural disasters when people are really conscientious. Just like right now we're here and I'm been looking and seeing that Harbin Hot Springs burned to the ground, which is a well-known hot springs resort in Northern California. And suddenly everybody's like a whole giant community is activated to be thinking about, you know, how to mitigate fire or why do we have these big fires, right? And so we keep having this succession of natural disasters. And every time there's this other little opening of people where the shell of their reality has been cracked a bit. And so at this point, we need a real acceleration of action and of consciousness. And so when these events happen, it's time to tap them into the permaculture message. So that was kind of a brainstorm we had today.
I went to Rico's talk today, and it gave me a different kind of spin than the talk that I went to with you in the conference where you were introducing the permaculture international design group.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, okay, that's something actually I'd like you to talk about. You don't have to talk about it if you don't want to, but
yeah.
It's actually the bit about he was talking about was how you got onto some project in China where they're talking about redesigning Chinese cities. Is that you or is that somebody else?
It wasn't redesigning Chinese cities,
yeah.
But I was initially, I had some students who had gone out and after they took their PDC, they went and hung their shingle out. And this one guy was a graphic designer and a web designer and had really good SEO skills. So he built this website and got it really high in the search engines. And the tag words, oh, permaculture design, organic, this and that. And he got contacted by this Chinese developer who they were building this huge luxury resort on this island, in this lake. And they wanted to build an American-style organic farm as part of their resort. And so they had gotten in touch with him, and just by going and Googling, basically going on the search engine, and through that and a few other experiences with being contacted by big investors, I realized that there's a lot of forces out there that have a lot of capital that are getting turned on to permaculture. I mean, the permaculture meme is exploding, right? There's just so much media out there. And there's people out there looking for professional firms that appear professional that can actually handle big projects. And I notice when you go and you do a survey of permaculture websites, you come up with these websites where, oh, we do permaculture design, we do farm tours, we sell eggs, we do permaculture design classes, and we have square dancing in our barn kind of thing. So it was like this real diverse, nobody was saying, this is a professional international design firm. We do big projects. This is who we are. Here's examples of our work, and really focusing in on that. So we decided, a number of us, eight of us, that all are people that have been working as professional designers for a number of years, most of us in the 15 to 20 year range, if we got together and we conglomerated our portfolios and we conglomerated our skill sets, that we were a pretty potent team. And what we couldn't accomplish between the eight of us, we know practically everybody in this field because we're also geographically dispersed. So we put together Permaculture Design International as a professional looking face that someone who is a big developer could go to the website, they could see examples of our work, they could read our portfolios, and they could see a clean, well-communicated message. And even though we haven't even really done our hard launch yet, we already have all of these, just through our networks, we have all of this interest in these projects that are at a larger scale than any one of us could have done. So it's already working, and we haven't even really officially started yet. So I feel like it is a major niche out in the world that is waiting to be filled. Yeah.
So has this been done before? Do you feel like you have competition? Are there other startups similar to yours that you think might be?
Yeah. So of course we've done an extensive survey of who's doing what. And there are people that are close, but not quite, right? Another thing is we called it Permaculture Design International, to make a name that was really not obscure at all. That, in fact, your search terms were the name of the business. So it's very clear what we do, and we are just putting that forward. So you can look around, and there are other places. Oh, this team, you know, is doing this, and might be this team of really accomplished people. There might be a list of, you know, 10, 15 people that are like, wow, all these people working together. But if you go deeper, there's not a whole lot there. It's just a very loose affiliation. So I haven't seen anybody with our number coming through and putting it forward as intentionally, blatantly as us.
Yeah, what I'm kind of going for here,
okay,
is more like not competition, but cooperation.
Yeah.
That you're actually a consortium or a conglomeration where it's an open source Rolodex kind of thing, where if you need somebody to do some particular role, that's where you want to go. So maybe you could talk about needing more permaculturists, more people who are past the point where they've now got a little bit of experience and they need bigger projects.
Yeah. So what we are trying to do is become a conglomeration. Basically, we want to be an attractor of big projects, and we want to create work for the masses. You know, so creating right livelihoods. One of the big failures of permaculture is that so few people that go through a permaculture design course actually come out and have employment to utilize the best of their skills. So a lot of, you know, we're not taking advantage of the most brilliant people coming through courses, really. So if we can create a system that has lots of work for lots of people, then we can advance people's experience more rapidly. So that's part of it. And so we're looking at one of the questions. We're giving a presentation tomorrow, and it's more of like a working session. We're really presenting what we're our main vision, and then we're presenting topics that we are still working on, that we're trying to find the edge, and we're hoping to crowdsource to get input on that. And one of those things is, what does a growth model look like? Because we don't want to draw a circle around this thing and say, okay, there's this many people, that's it, like a conventional firm. We're like, how do we create a pattern where the firm can actually grow and maintain its ethics and maintain its systems, but not be finite? So we haven't cracked that nut yet, but that's our intention with it.
So let me ask you, shift gears a bit here. Now, you mentioned that you were part of this climate change working group. As you look at the situation in the world, knowing what you know about the rapid pace of climate change and climate chaos and weirding and the stuff that's happening in the world, and you look at Ponzianomic finance of the economic systems and the weirdness of governments around the world, finite resources being exceeded, biodiversity crashing, sixth extinction underway. Do you have any reason for hope?
Yes, I do have reason for hope. because if we don't have hope and a positive outlook, then we're not going to come up with the magical creative solutions that we need, right? So I've spent a lot of my life being really weighed down by this big picture thing. And the one thing I do know is that it's going to have to be this incredible leap in our species, basically, where suddenly we have a greater mass understanding of our connection with the earth. I don't know how we're going to turn this ship around unless we really have this, somehow this kind of new collective understanding. And that collective understanding can only come about from a positive mind frame, right? Because it's going to have to be something that taps into our greatest creative potential as a species to solve our problems. So I have reason to hope, also because the people I know that are really doing good work just seem to be getting better and doing better and better work. And especially coming to a place like the International Permaculture Convergence here, it's like a rich, vibrant marketplace of amazing projects. And once you kick these systems into place, once you create permaculture systems that start to regenerate soil, regenerate water, they take off on their own. So a lot of it is we just have to seed these processes. And we're talking a lot here on the conference about, you know, how do we raise the permaculture army? Or, you know, how do we train masses of people that when civilization is ready to actually direct its resources towards earth repair and abundance, that we're going to be ready to answer the call? Because we're not ready yet to answer the call. We're still building capacity, I feel.
That was Andrew Millison talking with Albert Bates at the latest International Permaculture Convergence. Millison is a professional permaculture designer working out of Corvallis, Oregon. Find links in my show blog at ecoshock.info. It's fair to say this world, our times, are suffering from growing pains. As a core project of our civilization and existence, we grow food in unsustainable ways. That threatens the future, and we are destroying nature right now in the present. I'm convinced, in my little village plot, I have started down the road towards a culture that maybe could last through the ages. What about you? I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to these alternative voices on Radio EcoShock, and thank you for caring about our planet.
Well, what does this mean? Let's look at the definition of modern agriculture. It's the use of land to convert petroleum into food. And we can see the end of the petroleum.
Then our flight from reality and from the ideals of our founders will get this globe of ours torn to hot flinders spinning gases. To us citizens of Green Prairie, this promise of inferno poses a simple question. What new folly can you dream up with your coffee, your grapefruit, your first cigarette to keep yourself a while longer from facing the truth?
Anyway, 3 gallons of petrol left in this accursed ruin of a town. What's the good of sitting here a job like this? Nothing will ever fly again. Flying's over. Everything's over. Civilization's dead.
Why? Because people like you are the only life insurance left to this country, that's why. The other gilt-edged policies have all run out. First the friendship of the other great powers, then our lead on the bomb.
Well, now I think we're joined by Zafar Benkesh. Are you there, sir?
Yes. Hello, Phil. Yes, I am.
Hello, Zafar. Thank you very much for joining us. And I'll tell our listeners that we expect to speak to you again later this evening because we want to get your thoughts from an Islamic Muslim perspective on the way this campaign went. But we'll save that question for later.
That's right.
But that'll come up tonight. So there, people have to tune in to know what Zafar's thoughts are on that matter. But let's I think we have to have some war news here. We have the situation. Just name the names. There's one is in Yemen, where Saudi Arabia is happily bombing the poorest country in the region, and with the silent agreement, maybe loud agreement, of the Western powers. You have Syria, where the fighting seems to be taking an important turn, and also in Iraq. I guess what I want to know, the first question is, the Iraq and Afghanistan have both suddenly, I suppose to the shock of Washington, said to the Russians, maybe you should consider coming here. I mean, I don't think there's been a formal question, but what do you make of that?
Well, this is a very, very interesting development. First of all, in Iraq, since the Russian aerial assault on these terrorist groups in Syria that started on September the 30th, and just to remind your listeners that this was completely legal and legitimate because the Syrian government had specifically asked the Russians for help, unlike the previous American and its whatever allies' activities were in Syria. They were completely illegal and also completely ineffective because they were not really doing anything or any damage to the terrorist groups. Mm-hmm. So when Russia launched its operations against these terrorist groups at the request of the Syrian government on September the 30th, so we are basically talking about a three-week period. In these 3 weeks, Russia has degraded these terrorist groups far more than what the Americans and their allies were able to do in nearly 16 months.
Mm-hmm.
So,
by the way, it might be argued that they actually weren't doing anything, isn't it? I mean, their behavior there is very suspicious now. In light
exactly.
of when the Russians showed what can be done, it makes you wonder, was all that talk about bombing really anything?
Exactly. In fact, there is ample evidence that far from bombing these terrorist groups, what the Americans and the British were doing was dropping weapons to them instead of bombing them. So basically, it was just shadow boxing, as they say. It was just a pretense that the Americans and their allies were maintaining. But with respect to the Russian operations, the Iraqis saw how effective the Russians are in Syria. So they have asked the Russians to extend their operations to Iraq as well. Now, this request comes at a time when the Iraqi army has already launched a fairly significant operation in the area that these terrorist groups control, mm-hmm. particularly in the very, very troublesome Anbar province, but also its neighboring province of Salahuddin, where Iraq's largest refinery at Beji is located. But, of course, the refinery has now been completely destroyed, yet the Iraqi army was able to retake that refinery, and they have also taken full control of the city of Ramadi, which is the stronghold of these terrorist groups. So the Iraqi army is now coming down from the north as well as pushing from the south, in fact, from three sides, from another place called Hawija. So there are basically three directions from which the Iraqi army is now closing in on this city of Ramadi. Mm-hmm. And naturally, their progress is a little slow because much of that area has been booby-trapped and there are snipers all over. So they are making steady but slow progress. Mm-hmm. And it is in this context that the Iraqi army has asked the Russians to help them as well.
Yeah, and by the way, what I find that it is clearly, people who spend any time looking into military tactics understands that air power works as support for ground troops. But when somebody says, oh, I just flew by and I shot somebody, that isn't military. That's not even tactics. That's just murder. And it won't accomplish. But if you have an army and it knows where it wants to move, air power is perfect.
That is correct, yes. In fact, that is what is happening both in Iraq and in Syria, because since the Russian bombing campaign in Syria, the Iraqi army and its allied militias have made significant progress in several areas, several provinces, including Hama province, north of Damascus, in the areas that the terrorist groups had controlled, in Latakia, as well as in Aleppo. So it seems that there is a whole range of areas that the Syrian army is now moving in a significant way against these terrorist groups, in conjunction with the Russian Air Force bombing the terrorist hideouts and their ammunition dumps, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And in Iraq, in fact, last week there was another significant development, and that was that the Iraqi intelligence was able to find out that the leader of the terrorist group, a man by the name of al-Baghdadi, as he calls himself,
mm-hmm.
he was heading for a meeting in Anbar province with his senior commanders. And Iraqi intelligence were able to get wind of this. The Iraqi Air Force was mobilized, and the convoy in which al-Baghdadi was traveling was bombed. And there have been reports. These have also been carried by the BBC, The Guardian, and a number of other newspapers, including the New York Times,
mm-hmm.
that al-Baghdadi was apparently wounded. To what degree is not known, but he definitely was wounded in this airstrike.
Mm.
And then, of course, he was whisked away from there.
At last, there's an Iraqi Air Force. I used to open my questions with you is, when are they going to get one? They still don't actually have a full Air Force, do they?
That is correct. In fact, you know, the planes that they are flying, there's an interesting history to this. In the year 2003, when the United States launched its – sorry, actually, it was even earlier than that, in 1991 – the first time that the United States attacked Iraq, the Iraqi Air Force, about 30 or 40 of their Mirage fighters, were flown from Iraq towards Iran. And Iran, they landed in Iran, and of course Iran took possession of those planes. And the pilots, they didn't mistreat the pilots in any way, despite the fact that
mm-hmm.
there had been animosity.
I remember that, a dramatic story.
Exactly. But now that Iraq, since the Americans pulled out of Iraq, Iran returned all of those planes to Iraq.
Wow. That is a story. That's a big – that is
exactly.
definitely not on the – it's only on a Taylor report, folks.
Exactly. Each and every one of those planes was returned to Iraq, and Iran did not even ask for the Iraqis for any compensation for the damage that had been caused in the eight-year war.
Mm-hmm.
They said that was done by somebody else. Now there is a new government. We want to have friendly relations with this new government. We are not going to penalize you for something
wow.
for which you were not responsible. So those are the planes that the Iraqi Air Force is now using against these terrorist groups.
Talk about long-term thinking. Definitely that is the homeland of chess.
Yes, absolutely.
It is Iran, is it not? It invented chess, is my understanding.
That's correct, yes, yeah. absolutely. And you mentioned Afghanistan. Again, you're right. Although Afghanistan has not formally asked for Russian help, but they are seriously thinking about it because these terrorist groups have emerged in Afghanistan as well. And last week, Russia and its CIS partners, the Commonwealth of Independent States partners, they agreed to set up a joint task force
mm-hmm.
that would protect the borders of these states from terrorist infiltration from Afghanistan. So, in other words, the country...
Now, there's a healthy idea, a joint task force.
Absolutely. So, this is basically countries that border Afghanistan, which would include Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and, of course, Kyrgyzstan. And all of these countries have agreed to that, to establish a joint task force. And they're thinking ahead. Actually, they are, you know, they know that if these terrorist groups were allowed to operate the way they are doing in the region, and unfortunately many of the governments are actually financing and supporting them, including the Saudi regime and Kuwaitis and Qataris and so on, and Turks. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the Russians as well as the Commonwealth of Independent States are taking precautionary measures to protect their borders and to protect their society.
Let me have one quick question I have to ask you is, Turkey now, by the way, they have an election, I believe, coming up in November, but the leaders there seem to be dancing like a cat on a hot tin roof, as they say. I can't from day to day tell what it is they think is going on.
Yes, they are got themselves in a very big, deep hole, and definitely the Turkish people are certainly not in favor of the policies that Erdogan and his prime minister Davutoglu have formulated, particularly relating to Syria and Turkey's support for these terrorist groups. Your listeners would recall that last week there was a massive bombing in Ankara. And although the Turkish government is blaming it on these terrorist groups, the fact is that rally was held by the pro-Kurdish political party. And that party naturally has been targeted by Erdogan and his supporters because they made gains in the June parliamentary elections. And now, unfortunately, Erdogan is playing to this nationalistic Turkish card, arousing hatred against the Kurdish people, which is a very, very negative and short-sighted policy, because it is going to affect Turkey in a very negative way. And most Turks are not happy with this. They do not wish to have that kind of a policy being pursued. But unfortunately, Erdogan seems to be hell-bent. And he's causing a lot of damage to Turkey itself, because of the fact that he has, you know, pursued this very, very foolish policy vis-a-vis Syria and support for these terrorist groups, which the majority of Turks do not support. And I think this would be reflected in the November 1st parliamentary election that have to be held again, because in the June elections, Erdogan's party did not get a majority in parliament. It was reduced to a minority, and the parliament is dysfunctional right now, so a second election is being held. And I think probably the result is not going to be much different as far as Erdogan's party is concerned. It's not likely to get any more seats than it did in the last election.
Well, I'm glad you told us all that, and we'll look forward to talking to you in the future about that subject. It's Zafar Bengash, Crescent International. Thank you very, very much. We look forward to talking to you later tonight.
It's my great pleasure, Phil. Take care.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye. Zafar Bengash. Crescent-online.net, I believe. I'm doing that from memory. You're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and we, of course, on the web, taylor-report.com.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Andrew Coburn, Washington editor with Harper's Magazine, who discusses damning assessments of the U.S. military's drone warfare program revealed in recently published secret documents. Mary Grant of Food and Water Watch, who talks about her group's campaign to stop the privatization of water resources across the U.S. while promoting affordability and water quality. And Jack Cushman, a reporter with Inside Climate News, who summarizes his publication's groundbreaking investigative report on what Exxon knew about climate change and its decision to promote disinformation. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
With the renewal of U.S.-Cuban relations and improved economic ties, a new housing boom is underway in Havana. Handmade for sale signs hang outside many old colonial homes as new condo complexes are under construction in sight of decaying older buildings. For now, the U.S. embargo makes it illegal for Americans to buy real estate in Cuba, but prices are rising in anticipation of a massive future spike in housing values and plenty of under-the-table sales to foreigners. While a modest $55,000 house may be a steal in South Florida, it is still out of reach for most Cubans. Speculation has already taken hold with million-dollar listings for a four-bedroom penthouse in Havana. Sandra Arias, a foreign language professor, has gone into the real estate business seeking out foreign buyers, mostly Canadians, the French, and Russians. The thawing of U.S.-Cuban relations has generated excitement among realtors and new opportunities for families who often live in cramped living conditions. An enormous coal-fired power plant carved out of a virgin forest sits 300 miles south of New Delhi. It's a sign of India's economic ambitions to catch up with Chinese industrialization requiring cheap electricity. The Sasan power plant, with financing from the U.S. Export-Import Bank, has triggered various land disputes and displaced villagers who are facing new economic hardship. According to the Los Angeles Times, India wants to bring electricity to 300 million people by exploiting locally available coal supplies. By boosting its use of dirty coal, the Indian government is ignoring global demands to reduce the nation's greenhouse emissions. In a village near the Sasan plant, a mountain of mining waste now surrounds brick and mud huts. In 2014, India's Ministry of Environment and Forests ruled the plant's mining waste was illegally being dumped in forests, and the project's developer, Reliance Power, failed to restore lost green space. Reliance Power promised benefits to local communities, including cheap electricity, new housing, and schools. Yet most of these promises have been broken. Farmer Ramji Besor lives next to the Sasan plant, where coal dust now covers his crops and has gotten into his irrigation water supply. He was offered $26,000 to leave his land, but rejected it since the money didn't cover the cost of buying a new farm as land prices soared while the power plant was being built. On October 13th, the 3rd District Court of Appeals reinstated a federal lawsuit by Muslim residents of New Jersey against the New York City Police Department for broad surveillance of Muslim communities, including mosques and businesses. An investigation by the Associated Press uncovered a decade-long surveillance program run by the NYPD against Muslim communities in New York and New Jersey. The squad in charge of the sweeps, known as the Demographics Unit, was disbanded by New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio in 2014. The appeals court ruling overturned a decision by Federal District Court Judge William Martini, who dismissed the case, claiming that the Muslim plaintiffs hadn't suffered any harm. In contrast, the appeals court compared the NYPD intelligence gathering operation to the Red Scare of the 1940s and 50s. Judge Thomas Ambrose wrote, "We have been down this road before. Jewish Americans during the Red Scare, African Americans during the Civil Rights Movement, and Japanese Americans during World War II. Bahar Azmi, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, declared, "This case of religious profiling is the other side of the stop-and-frisk coin. There is no Muslim exception to the Constitution." Glenn Caton, legal director of Muslim Advocates, which was a co-counsel in the case, said the group looked forward to pursuing the lawsuit to ensure that no American should be spied on simply because of the way he or she prays. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
An anonymous whistleblower working within a U.S. intelligence agency recently leaked secret documents to the online investigative publication The Intercept. The documents provide an uncensored view of the U.S. drone warfare program's operations in Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia between 2011 and 2013. The source of the documents said they provided this information to the press because they believe the public has a right to understand the process by which people are placed on kill lists and ultimately assassinated on orders from the highest echelons of the U.S. government. The Intercept's 8-part series of articles, titled The Drone Papers, reveals the flaws in the Pentagon's 14-year air campaign conducted against suspected terrorists that has used unreliable information to make life-and-death decisions in the assassination program. The unknown number of civilians killed in these operations has served to outrage entire communities and has been used as a recruiting tool by anti-Western and terrorist groups. The authors of the Intercept series expressed hope that their investigation will provoke a public debate on the legal and moral consequences of a secret assassination program with little or no oversight or checks and balances. Your reporter spoke with Andrew Coburn, Washington editor with Harper's Magazine, and author of a new book on the U.S. drone program titled Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. Here, Coburn discusses the value of these documents in assessing the deadly flaws evident in the U.S. military's drone warfare program.
Really, this program doesn't work very well. It's presented generally, officially, as a program, that's incredibly precise and accurate and clean, and we go after the really bad people who are trying to do us harm, and we really don't sort of harm anyone else, and no Americans get killed, and it's all kind of very surgical and almost antiseptic. What, we've known for some time, and these documents confirm, is that actually it's not really like that. I mean, for instance, in one operation described in the documents, in this Operation Haymaker in the early stages, out of 200 people they killed, only 35 were actually the actual targets they were going after. The rest went down as EKIA, enemy killed in action. But, I mean, there's something I have to say. The most important thing people have to understand about the drone technology is just how imprecise it is. I'll give you one rather startling fact, which I found out about, which I wrote about, which is at night, which is half the time when they're using infrared, the main infrared sensor they use, or infrared camera, if you like, has a visual acuity of 20 over 200. I mean, we all hear about 20/20 vision, which is perfect vision. Well, 20 over 200 vision is very, very poor vision. In fact, it's the legal definition of blindness for most DMVs in this country. So we're sending legally blind machines to kill people. So no wonder they get it wrong.
These new documents, as well as reporting, such as in your book, Kill Chain, talk about the unreliability of the intelligence upon which these assassinations via drone are based. Maybe you can speak about the particular mechanism of targeting an individual known as signature strikes, which is really not based on any intelligence, but is in fact based only on a person's observed movement as the drone looks down with the camera.
That's right, or your behavior. It's also called activity-based intelligence. I mean, if you sort of behave like what they think a terrorist looks like, and give off signals that they have determined indicates that you must be a terrorist, then they strike. In my book, I give an account of what was really a signature strike by the Air Force, not the CIA, in 2010. It was a small group of three vehicles carrying a bunch of poor people on their way to Kabul, going through very mountainous, remote territory in central Afghanistan. And there was a drone watching them because there was not too far away, there was an American ground force that was going to go and do a raid on a village. And it was the middle of the night. And so they saw these vehicles, and they saw that they met up, and two of the vehicles flashed their lights at a third. So they thought, this is suspicious. Then they couldn't see, this 20 over 200 business. All they could see were through the infrared, there were sort of blobs of the people in the vehicles, but they thought they might have seen a rifle. In fact, it was probably a turkey
one of the passengers were carrying to as presents to their relatives in Kabul. Then they stopped. The vehicle stopped on a riverbank as dawn was breaking, and it looked like they were getting out to pray. And this was identified as something the Taliban do, which, of course, you know, a billion Muslims do pray as well, so it wasn't very clear. Then they were heading toward the American detachment, and that was a sign that they were, you know, going to attack this special forces unit on the ground. Then they turned away from the unit on the ground, and this was put down to a flanking maneuver. So everything was made to fit this sort of preset pattern. And finally, they attacked, you know, attacked these vehicles and killed 23 civilians, including a couple of children. So that's the problem with signature strikes. You know, you think you know, you can identify exactly what you're looking at, but you can't. I mean, things always goes wrong, which is why, you know, they killed so many civilians.
A U.S. and Italian aid worker were both killed by U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan back in January 2015, while they were being held captive by al-Qaeda in Pakistan. President Obama later came out with an apology here, which was kind of unprecedented in the history of the drone program. But is there any hope that this entire program can be reformed, restrained, restructured to make it more accountable and to make it comply with U.S. laws that govern life and death decisions?
I don't think so. How could you have a – if you decide this is what you really want to do is to be able to assassinate people in remote parts of the world, obviously without warning because then it wouldn't work, how can you have a trial? You know, how can you have any kind of judicial process for it? I think the whole idea of an assassination program is so misguided, you know, morally, you know, legally, and, you know, militarily. You know, I mean, I've talked to enough military people who think it's a really bad idea from the point of view of fighting a war for some of the reasons that, you know, I mentioned earlier, like, you know, you end up with someone worse. So I think the whole thing should be, you know, shut down for all of the above reasons.
That was Andrew Coburn, Washington editor with Harper's Magazine and author of a new book on the U.S. drone warfare program titled Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. Find links to The Intercept's Drone Papers series and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. With the deterioration and lack of investment in the nation's public water supply delivery systems, more water disasters are in the headlines. From a chemical spill in a West Virginia river in January 2014 that affected 300,000 people, to the reports this month of serious contamination of the water in Flint, Michigan. More efforts are underway to privatize water that has historically been a public resource, both in the U.S. and around the world. At the same time, the growth in the sale of bottled water that consumers purchase on their own has accompanied and exacerbated the privatization trend. Corporate water privatization deals appeal to many cash-strapped cities and towns in need of costly infrastructure retrofits. But once in control of a vital public resource, corporations often use their monopoly to raise the cost of drinking water without public accountability. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Mary Grant, director of the Food and Water Watch Public Water for All campaign. Here she describes her group's work, promoting the protection and affordability of the nation's water supply by fighting privatization bids and advocating for increased federal investment.
Our Public Water for All campaign, we coordinate with local communities that are working to oppose the privatization of their water system, to support community efforts that are seeking public control of their water systems from private entities. And also we support water affordability programs.
It seems we're hearing more about water problems, from the disaster in West Virginia last year that affected 300,000 consumers, to news just this week that the water in Flint, Michigan is contaminated.
Yes, yeah, so we do see increasing instances, or at least, I don't know if it's getting worse, but we're seeing more news about it, more concern about water quality problems, and our understanding of water quality contamination is getting better, so we know the health effects of contamination. So in communities like Flint, we were proud to work with What Are You Fighting For, a local organization that was working to reconnect the city's water back to Detroit water. When they switched from Detroit water to Flint River water, and the community experienced serious problems with the water quality, in particular lead poisoning in their water. And then more children are having their high levels of lead in their blood. So that's a serious issue, and it's because of the corrosion in the pipes from the switch to Flint River water. It's more corrosive, and they didn't have the proper remediation chemicals included in the water. But we do see that this is an important issue. It remains an important issue. Since the founding of our organization, we've worked with communities working on fighting water privatization. They've reached out to us, and they need support to keep their water systems in local public hands. But what we're seeing as a growing problem is affordability. Federal funding for water and sewer systems has been decreasing. Water quality standards are getting more stringent as we understand more about the contaminants in our water. And our climate is changing. So these factors are increasing the cost of infrastructure improvements that we need in order to provide safe water. So the issue becomes, how do you pay for it? With federal funding dwindling, rates are going up in communities across the country. Water rates are regressive. So they pose a disproportionate burden on low-income households. A solution that we see is having water affordability programs to address that issue of increasing water rates and regressive water bills to ensure that everyone has access to safe and affordable water service.
Did you say that climate change is a contributing factor in these problems?
Yeah, climate change is an issue for many communities, especially coastal communities that are seeing rising water levels. There's more flood events. There's droughts, changing climate, extremes in weather events that are affecting our water utilities that people have to plan for and make improvement projects to plan for and to protect their water supplies.
Mary Grant, I've heard it said, and this is at least partly by water companies themselves, who obviously have a vested interest, that water is the most undervalued of any of the utilities in America, and that in order to protect water quality and update infrastructure, water bills will naturally have to go up.
We think that water is priceless. It's invaluable. And so the water itself is a common resource. There is a cost to treating and distributing the water. And we want to make sure that those costs, that burden of those costs, are allocated equitably so that we're not overburdening low-income households. The intention of the affordability work that we're doing. But we also want to, ensure that all the money, all the revenue collected from water and sewer rates are going back into the system. We don't want to have profiting off of our water and sewer services. They're such essential services necessary for public health and well-being that we can't have money going out of the system.
Who exactly provides the water to communities?
I think 9 out of 10 people have water service from their local government. There are water companies, particularly in the Northeast, that these are investor-owned water companies in the Northeast that provide regional areas. So there are regional water companies, and then there are national water companies like American Water and Aqua America that serve mostly more rural communities, because there's rural communities and statewide in different states. And then we also have international, multinational water corporations like Suez and Veolia that are involved in water provision.
Isn't American Water the company responsible for the contamination disaster in West Virginia?
That was American Water. It's the largest water company in the United States. Oh, it's actually interesting. There's a local community group in West Virginia right now that are seeking local public control of their water system from American Water, in part because of the response they've seen to the water contamination that they think is inadequate, that the company responded poorly to the water contamination and didn't prepare for and plan for.
The fact that over the past 20 or 25 years, so many people have been convinced that bottled water is better, even though much of that just comes from public water supplies, there's very little oversight of the industry. How has that affected the whole situation of providing quality, affordable water to people?
That is a major concern, that there is this public perception that our tap water is unsafe, so people don't want to invest in it. And then who can afford bottled water? Maude Barlow talks about a two-tier water system. You have people who can afford this bottled water, and then you have people who, are stuck with tap water, and if you're not having the people who can afford bottled water invest in our tap water system, where does it leave our tap water system?
That was Mary Grant, director of the Food and Water Watch Public Water for All campaign. For more information on the group's work to ensure safe, affordable public water supplies, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Pulitzer Prize-winning online news site InsideClimateNews.org has published a groundbreaking investigative report that revealed that ExxonMobil Corporation, the largest and most powerful oil company in the world, had known through its own cutting-edge scientific research that climate change presented a serious threat to the Earth's environment as early as the late 1970s. Despite that knowledge, Exxon spent more than two decades providing millions of dollars in funding to individuals and groups, promoting the myth that climate change was uncertain. The authors of the six-part series, titled Exxon: The Road Not Taken, using Exxon's own internal documents and citing interviews with former Exxon employees and federal officials, conclude that once the oil giant realized that government limits on the production of greenhouse gases would cut into its profits, it worked to sow doubt about the reality of global warming and lobbied to block federal and international regulations to control carbon emissions. Your reporter spoke with Jack Cushman, a reporter with Inside Climate News, who summarizes his publication's investigative report on Exxon and its possible impact at the upcoming United Nations Conference on Climate Change in Paris this December.
You know, in the way that the Pentagon Papers illuminated the Vietnam War's realities when they were finally released, we thought, let's go back and see what we can find out from the earliest days of climate research. And so we started doing the things that investigative journalists do, going to records, going to archives, reading hearings, finding people, interviewing people who were active in Exxon at the time. Exxon, of course, was the largest oil company, close to the largest oil company and one of the largest corporations in the world. And as it happened, we were kind of surprised to learn that Exxon alone among oil companies was very actively engaged in climate research in the 1970s. And we simply hadn't been aware of it, let alone of the character of the research they were doing, rigging an oil tanker to take actual ocean samples to see what the carbon flux was between the atmosphere and the ocean, and doing all kinds of imaginative research. They even proposed at one point getting 100 bottles of vintage French wine from back over the decades to see what radiocarbon isotopes of were in the wine and help determine what part of the atmospheric carbon was coming from fossil fuels and what from other sources. And it was really quite extraordinary. And in fact, we use words to describe it like extraordinary, farsighted, ambitious, rigorous, a model of corporate responsibility, even altruistic. Now Exxon says we misrepresented them, but we're puzzled to find that they would think that was a misrepresentation. So in among these documents, here's what we found. Exxon was so closely engaged in the science that it clearly understood the emerging risks of climate change. We're not saying that they knew exactly what was going to happen for the next 30 years. Nobody did, and science is always uncertain. But they knew enough to know that the Earth was warming, that climate change was probably due in part to man-made emissions of fossil fuels, their product, that this was likely enough that as the temperatures continued to rise and the signal emerged from the noise, a point which has long since passed, governments would begin to take actions, and that based on the current understanding of the science, those actions would probably mean cutting down on the use of fossil fuels, hence an existential risk to Exxon. And this was spelled out in many ways, and in documents we went through hundreds of documents, we went through a lot of interviews, we went through other sources that are already on the record, and this was a little examined time, and we wanted to examine Exxon's subsequent record of influencing climate policy by muddying the science in the light of what they knew in the early days. And so as we looked at these documents, we found a very early briefing to the board, which explored all the uncertainties involved in the emergent state of climate change as of 1977, and which presented the conclusion, and it was in a long document, but as journalists, you pick up a document and you look for the summary. And so
this document was a summary, an extensive summary of a presentation to top management by a senior scientist. And the summary he wrote down in order to be able to share this much more broadly within the corporation. And it was, a fairly detailed document of many pages. So under the word summary, that document presented its conclusion, and it said, in the first place, there's general scientific agreement that the most likely manner in which mankind is influencing the global climate is through carbon dioxide release from the burning of fossil fuels. And to us, that was a revelation. That was news. And so we took it from there, and what you have now is a six-part series of tens of thousands of words that goes into really extraordinary detail about Exxon's earliest engagement with climate science, and then a discussion of what's much better known, their decades of undermining the science.
What effect do you think is likely of your investigation on ExxonMobil, what they knew and what they didn't know about climate change? What effect do you think that'll have on the important meeting that's going to be taking place in Paris, France, at the UN Climate Summit this December?
Well, I think that in terms of the climate science, you know, the horse has gone from the barn at this point. This year, once again, is the warmest year ever recorded. So I don't think Exxon really has much chance of influencing the outcome of these negotiations. The rest of the world's oil companies, by and large, are going to the negotiators and saying, we need certainty and we need an approach that gets us to the international targets. And Exxon and a handful of other mostly American oil companies are outside that group, but I think the tide is moving against them.
That was Jack Cushman, a reporter with InsideClimateNews.org. Find links to the group's six-part series titled Exxon, The Road Not Taken, and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
The representative or the represented? Recently, a black congresswoman from Florida revealed that white legislators from the state's redistricting body changed her district to include the state's overcrowded but underrepresented prisons, thereby ensuring her defeat when the next election comes around for prisoners can't vote. While legislator Corinne Brown, Democrat from the 5th District, has a claim, the better solution shows us how the Congressional Black Caucus has failed its constituencies and its members by not fighting for deeper, broader voting rights, like enfranchisement of prisoners. In South Africa, the post-apartheid government opened the door to prisoner voting. The same practice holds for Israel. If the Congressional Black Caucus had fought for and prevailed on prisoner enfranchisement, Representative Brown would have no viable argument against the redistricting process, for prisoners would be allowed to vote for anyone, just as everyone can. The nation that claims to be a democracy should not exclude people from voting, but seek the broadest, deepest constituency. All of the people should be represented, not just some. The prisoner exclusion from voting arises from state attempts to weaken black political power after Reconstruction, which outlawed all black voting under white supremacist governments and legislatures. The echoes of that tradition remains a principle in American law, with little other than tradition itself as justification. This is no solution to the crisis of mass incarceration, not by a long shot. Mao famously said, "Politics is war without bloodshed." It has its place, too, to combat the extreme isolation facing captives of the biggest imprisonment boom on earth. It's not a solution. It's not a talisman to be worshipped. It's a tool, and the oppressed need every tool that they can touch. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Sending her to a hard fall to the floor on her back. Before she can disentangle herself from the desk chair, she is seized and thrown across the room like a rag doll. She is immediately handcuffed and arrested for disturbing her classroom. According to published accounts, she was said to have been a non-participant in class and ordered to leave the classroom. When she refused to leave, the school's so-called resource officer was notified. When policeman Ben Fields arrived at the classroom, he went into Rambo mode on the child. The rest is infamy. Several months ago, a video showed a mad RoboCop assaulting a young teenage girl in a bikini. This latest police attack on a young girl is almost identical, except it happened in a classroom. Consider this. The girl in class never assaulted anyone. She merely refused to leave. Was this more disturbing than the madcap cop response, which looked more at home in a WWE ring than a classroom? It tells us the nature of public schools, and more ominously, the nature of police. Are cops there to protect the students or the staff from the students? What is the function of teachers? To teach obedience or to teach freedom? Events such as these show us an ugly, uncomfortable truth about American schools and how they interact in the lives of children, especially black children. The imagery of a beefy black cop throwing a white teenage girl across the classroom would have evoked an immediate response. That this has not speaks volumes about the degraded value of the lives and well-being of black children in America today. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Presidential elections are over a year from now. But if you relied on national media accounts, you'd think that they were all but imminent. But this isn't the elections. It's like an obstacle course a year ahead, a test for the wealthy, the well-connected, or those with moneyed support. It's long and expensive, not for the voters, but for the funders, those who buy or rent the candidates, to serve the interests of capital, not the people. If recent elections have proven anything, they have proved this, that candidates are chosen to betray the electorate and to serve Wall Street and the corporate elite. Few did this better than Bill Clinton, a master politician, a master betrayer. Blacks worshipped him as the first black president. Even as he savaged their interests to placate racist white fears and anxieties. He drove a stake into the middle class by supporting NAFTA and exporting jobs that never could be replaced. That fealty to Wall Street was duplicated during the terms of Barack Hussein Obama, and blacks lost more wealth during his administration than at any time since Reconstruction. Only belatedly, in his last months, has he addressed the horrors of the racist prison system and, pushed by protests, has begun to half-heartedly address the unrelenting savagery of police violence against blacks. Voting hasn't been our solutions. It's empowered forces that have exacerbated our problems. They have presented the illusion of progress while fastening new chains over our existence. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
How does the power structure of Russia differ from its Western counterparts? Is Vladimir Putin a dictator? Did Russia have an ulterior motive in launching airstrikes against the Islamic State? How have Russian moves forced a fundamental transformation of the Middle East? What bearing are the huge refugee flows out of Syria having on the regional situation? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, we take a closer look at how Russia is addressing the challenges confronting it in Ukraine, Syria, and other countries in its frontier. We hear from Boris Kagarlitsky, director of the Institute for Globalization Studies and Social Movements in Moscow, and from Andrew Korybko, a Moscow-based political commentator. On this week's program, Russia, Ukraine, Syria, and the Grand Chessboard. Conversations with Boris Kagarlitsky and Andrew Korybko. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 30th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. In response to Russia's bombing raids against ISIS, Washington is now contemplating to announce officially what they've been doing for the last four, their resolve to have boots on the ground in an extended military operation. Needless to say, this operation, if it were to be carried out without the UN Security Council's stamp of approval, would constitute a violation of international law. And another important development pertains to the statement by Defense Secretary Ashton Carter that while a no-fly zone is not contemplated in the immediate future by the Pentagon, it nonetheless remains an option. quote, President Barack Obama has not taken the option of a Syrian no-fly zone off the table, unquote. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, appointed by Washington, supports the U.S.-led war under a humanitarian banner. These various actions and threats by the U.S.-led coalition, not to mention the chatter pertaining to a World War III option in the corridors of the U.S. Congress, point to a scenario of military escalation which could potentially lead to direct military confrontation between the U.S.-led coalition and the Russian Federation. That comes from the article, Boots on the Ground Inside Syria, The Pentagon Comes to the Rescue of the Islamic State, by Professor Michelle Chosadovsky, posted October 28th. The Fed's response in America repeatedly confirms that our government no longer complies with U.S. rule of law explicitly guaranteed by our Constitution. The treasonous Obama regime has proven over and over again that it refuses to uphold our sacred First Amendment rights of free speech, peaceful assembly, and protest. Subsequently, since 9/11, domestic U.S. human rights violations have soared dramatically in recent years, revealing a sinister federal agenda to intentionally induce rising levels of civil unrest, chaos, violence, and widespread crises in order to then justify its thinly veiled excuse to ultimately declare martialized Obama law. And through our supreme dictator's unprecedented number of notoriously unconstitutional executive orders, possibly the next false flag may be the one that fulfills his militarized, tyrannical wet dream in the land of the enslaved. For decades, the federal government has been methodically planning and willfully inciting increasing levels of civil unrest, chaos, and citizen revolt amidst long-planned false flag crises, ultimately leading us to martial law and potentially to America's second civil war. That comes from the article, How the New World Order Globalists Are Dividing Americans, by Joachim Hagopian, posted October 28th. An extremely important story has come and gone in a flash, almost unnoticed like so many important stories. It revealed that President George W. Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair had agreed to invade Iraq long before the first bombs fell on the oil-rich Middle Eastern country. The story is important because it adds to our understanding of the essentially criminal disinformation put out to convince Americans, Britons, and the world that war was unavoidable. We'd all been told that Bush and Blair only acted after exhaustive efforts to determine whether Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and that in any case, their focus was on addressing that threat through all possible diplomatic options. In fact, as a leaked White House memo now shows, the UK was committed to backing the US-led invasion almost a year before the war started in March 2003. That comes from the article, Secret Email Leaked from Hillary's Server, The Real Story of Bush, Blair, and Big Oil's Iraq Agenda, by Russ Baker, posted October 28th, originally appearing at Who, What, Why. The U.S.-led anti-ISIL coalition targeted the Iraqi forces' position instead of ISIL terrorists in the western parts of Iraq. Quote, the coalition warplanes pounded the Iraqi forces after they advanced near the city of Ramadi after Al-Jama Bridge and Al-Davayjan Bridge, unquote, a security source said. He noted that at least 22 Iraqi forces, including volunteer forces known as Al-Hashad al-Shabi, were killed in the U.S.-led airstrikes in Ramadi. The U.S. has repeatedly struck the popular forces' positions in different parts of Iraq. In February, an Iraqi provincial official lashed out at the Western countries and their regional allies for supporting Takfiri terrorists in Iraq, revealing that the U.S. airplanes still continue to airdrop weapons and foodstuff for the ISIL terrorists. That comes from the article, U.S. Protects ISIS Terrorists in Ramadi. 22 Iraqi troops killed by U.S.-led airstrikes. U.S. planes drop weapons for ISIS, by Fars News Agency, posted October 28th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. This episode of the Global Research News Hour will examine Russian geostrategy in the face of pressures from the West and what animates the actions of Russia and its president, Vladimir Putin. We start our discussion with an interview with Boris Kagarlitsky. Kagarlitsky is a Russian dissident and was a political prisoner in the former USSR under Brezhnev. He was arrested again under Boris Yeltsin in 1993. He has run the Institute for Globalization Studies and Social Movements in Moscow, a leading Russian leftist think tank. We had a chance to meet up with Mr. Kagarlitsky during his recent speaking tour in Canada. Here's our conversation. There's a lot of misconceptions about Russia and its involvement in Ukraine, and I suspect a lot of misconceptions about Putin himself. And I'm wondering if you could help clear up some of those misconceptions, first of all by talking about the essential power dynamics and social structure of Russia. There are elite elements in Russian society, just as there are elite elements in Western society. And I'm wondering if you could maybe help distinguish between the two and how they express themselves at the political level.
Of course, Russian society is dominated by the oligarchic elite, but that can be said about most other societies. Of course, it depends how you define oligarchy, but I think, it's a capitalist oligarchy like in the United States or in Canada or in Great Britain, so it doesn't make a big difference. The difference, however, is that Russian corporations who are actually in control, they, of course, cannot run the country directly. They're running it through the political intermediaries who are actually establishing a very peculiar political system based on consensus building. All elites, all elite groups, all major interests are considered. And then Putin is a major mediator between these elites. So in that sense, once they discuss things, it's usually not very public. They work in a very kind of secret way, discussing major positions and demands and needs of different elite groups. And then once they reach consensus or agreement, then Putin appears and announces the decision. So in that sense, yes, it doesn't look like a Western model of a bourgeois democracy where these disagreements are usually publicly announced. Ironically, I think it's the only major difference, because in every single respect, it's very much the same. The main problem both here in the West and in Russia is that the real alternatives, which represent the interests of the masses, are usually excluded from this kind of debate. But again, in this case, Russia is not that different. It's just part of the current neoliberal world.
Mm-hmm. And just to touch on the pre collapse versus the post-Soviet collapse, those critical years in the late 80s and early 90s. I was wondering what your thoughts are about the major agencies, the major drivers that were pushing things in that direction. I mean, where were the oligarchs in terms of the need for change? Where was the wider public, the body politic, as we would call it, the working class? Who are the major drivers there?
In Ukraine or in Russia, or both?
I think both, yes.
Speaking about Ukraine, you see, the difference between Ukrainian model and the Russian model is that Russian model was based on the abundance of resources. So you have oil, it means there is a lot of money, and this money is always used to satisfy everybody in the elite. Every elite interest is more or less considered, and more, to be honest, Russian state was doing a reasonably good job in the last decade to satisfy some of the public demands as well. In that sense, for example, social spending increased, average wages increased, consumption increased. So it was not only the elites who were having their slice of a pie. but also some of the population, many people in the population, they've got some improvement. And that was exactly one of the reasons why Putin is so popular and why he's so stable, because people really benefited from the system of dynamic compromise. Comparing that with Ukraine, you can see that in Ukraine they always try to do basically the same but always failed because they didn't have this oil money, they didn't have these resources as Russia had, and that led to a permanent conflict within Ukrainian oligarchy. That led to the situation when popular demands were never considered or satisfied, and that led to the situation of permanent instability. So that every time there was an election, for example, it was challenged. Every time when you elected a parliament or a government, somebody said the election was actually not free or there was fraud and so on. So every time that somebody was trying to replay the results, undo the results of elections or any time there was a compromise, somebody disrespected the compromise, and every time there was an agreement, it was always broken. So in that sense, Ukrainian state looked like an example of permanent instability compared to Russian being an example of stability. But at the same time, the structure of interests behind both states is very much the same. That's the irony of the situation. And however, the collapse of Ukrainian state, which actually happened in February 2014, led to a lot of mass energy being released. So we've got a real mass protest and mass uprising in eastern Ukraine. People who were silent for years and years and years, they all of a sudden discovered that there was no way in the new Ukraine their interests would be represented, even considered. So they went into the streets, and while in Maidan, what you could see was mainly Kievan middle class, the middle class from the capital, who was protesting together with some people who were brought from western Ukraine. In Kharkov, Donetsk, Lugansk, Odessa, and so on, we saw working people actually getting to the streets. And the social difference is very visible. So the conflict in Ukraine is also a social conflict. Because on the one hand, you have some of the elites, and you have many representatives of nationalist intelligentsia with the middle classes from the capital, but the real working class is in opposition. Very often the workers' movement is suppressed, like it happened in Odessa, where they used a lot of violence to suppress protests, killing people, burning people alive, as we know, and so on. But still, I think the conflict is not that much about the language, whether it's about Ukrainian or Russian language. It's not only about pro-Western or pro-Russian orientation. It's very much about class. It's very much about whether the interests of working class should be considered or not in Ukrainian politics.
Yes, it's interesting. As you stated in your discussion about that, there's this effort to get consensus among all these different elements, but one element that gets left out is that of the the working people. So I guess I'm kind of curious then about just looking at how those elements, when they started to express their outrage, and there were certain currents running through Soviet society, and they found themselves suddenly deprived, and they had to express it outright. How would you assess the way Putin himself? I mean, you're not above being critical. I mean, how could the situation have been better managed, or has Putin managed the best way conceivable? What could have been done differently?
Putin managed the situation for himself and for Russian elites. So in that respect, I think it also could have been done better, in fact. But from the point of view of the toiling classes, of course, it can look very differently, because basically what happened was that especially in Donetsk and Lugansk, where there was no efficient bourgeois leadership at the first stage of rebellion, what happened was that It was definitely moving towards some kind of social change, and people were even speaking about some kind of social revolution, which of course was a bit of an exaggeration, but that was what people really wanted. At that very time, Moscow did everything to put things, as they thought, under control, which means blocking all the attempts to move the development towards social transformation, blocking the demands for nationalization, blocking other social demands, though in fact Novorossiya started calling itself Novorossian Project, this potential confederation of Lugansk and Donetsk, which never actually happened in practice, but remains a slogan. They were calling for some kind of welfare state and, or rather, social state. And, of course, that never happened in practice. Why? Because of the Ukrainian military starting an operation against their republics, the People's Republics. And then the republics started getting increasingly dependent on Moscow in terms of ammunition, weapons, food, and so on. And of course, later military specialists came, but we have to be very clear. The military advisors, they are present in Donetsk and Lugansk, but they appeared later. They appeared, say, mostly in August, while the military activities were already taking place in May. So it took a few months before a Russian military really appeared in the area. And nevertheless, Moscow used its capacity to provide ammunition and arms as a tool to blackmail the leadership of republics, to establish control over their decisions, and to prevent them from doing anything progressive. That also led to the situation of stalemate, because initially their movement was capable of expanding into other territories. People in Kharkov, people in Mariupol, people in Odessa were waiting for the ополчение, for the rebel militia to move in. But then, when the social liberation kind of appeal was effectively blocked, their desire to get ополчение entering these other cities among the population of these cities also started diminishing. And now people just want peace. So the main demand here, today, I think, is peace. People want the hostilities to be stopped. And to some extent, it does happen, because the actual shelling of Donetsk stopped recently. And we see that up to a point, ceasefire is respected. But nobody knows for how long.
Now, you say that there's this desire for peace, but I'm wondering about the role of the like ethnic tensions. I mean, we hear about the these ultra-nationalist groups, the Azov Battalion and so on, and I'm wondering if we're seeing a growth in that kind of, you know, whether it's, you know, ethnic hatred or whatever, or if those numbers are becoming diminished as part of this need to enter into some you know, element of stability. I mean, what is your take on these sort of divisive aspects?
I think it is very untrue to present what's happening in Ukraine as an ethnic conflict. It has very little to do, say, with the situation in Bosnia, say, or in Croatia at some point, or Kosovo, where you really did have an ethnic conflict, unfortunately, when people of different communities were killing each other just because they belonged to different communities. That never happened in Ukraine, never. Because the far right was using the ethnic card. It was using some kind of ethnic propaganda for its politics. But you never saw anything like ethnic conflict, like communities killing and attacking each other as communities, just for the reason that people belong to a different ethnicity or religion.
It's not in the character of the nation.
Not only, I'm not sure that it is not in the character of the nation. I don't think that it's in the character of Bosnians to kill each other. I think that just for some reasons, Ukrainian society managed to avoid that level of confrontation, just because everybody in Ukraine, or most people in Ukraine, with the exception of nationalist intelligentsia in Kyiv, understood that the conflict was not about ethnicity. It was not even about Russian or Ukrainian language. The conflict was about who was going to rule the country. It was about the interests of different groups of oligarchy in the beginning. And then it was about the right of the people of the East and South, not only for self-determination, but also just for respect and for the interests being considered by the state. So when they saw that working people, and I stress, these are the regions which produce most of the GDP of Ukraine, which are the productive regions, they're the ones where you have industry and transportation systems, networks, and so on, the ports, all these regions, when they discovered that they were totally victimized, ignored, their interests were totally ignored, then regional and class interests came to the fore, and everybody understood it was not so much about ethnicity, it was about, again, as I'm saying, about regional interests, and it was about social interests. But the far right is trying to ethnicize the conflict. That's another point. The far right and many representatives of Kievan intelligentsia, who hardly know any Ukrainian language, by the way, they're trying to do everything possible to ethnicize the conflict and to represent the conflict as if it is an ethnic confrontation between Russians and Ukrainians, which is simply not true.
And can you speak to the aspects of, like when we hear about foreign intervention in the conflict and Western media take about Russia, you know, interfering, but what about Western interference, like whether it's, you know, a few different NGOs or whatever? Can you speak to that point and how widespread that awareness is among the people in the region?
Well, first of all, I cannot imagine any Western country which wouldn't have reacted if similar things were happening next to their borders. Or
like Mexico, okay, in the United States.
I don't think imagine Canadian state collapses. What will be the reaction of the United States government? I think they would have been quite concerned about what's going to happen in Canada or I think in this case, they kind of deny Russia the right to do what they do always. And by the way, United States interfere in places which are much further away than Mexico or Canada. They interfere in Iraq, they interfere in Afghanistan, they interfere in Libya and so on, without even having American citizens there. So I think in that sense, when they're complaining about Russian government being concerned with events next door to major Russian cities, I think it's total hypocrisy. It doesn't mean that Russia does everything right. On the contrary, I think that Russian government does most of what it does, even when they want to do something good, they do it wrongly. But speaking about Western involvement, it's not just NGOs. If it were just NGOs, it wouldn't have been such a problem. Because you can have pro-American NGOs. Okay, we can compete with these NGOs, organizing our own NGOs and organizing social movements and so on. That's not such a problem. The real problem is that United States diplomats and politicians and military and financial experts were directly involved with the elites, giving them advice or even orders what to do. Also European Union was actually directly involved in the running of the post-February Ukrainian state, including foreigners who are now ministers in Ukraine. You can hardly have any European nation which has foreigners running whole ministries. I mean, not as advisors, I stress. They're not running them as advisors. They're official ministers who are appointed, of course, by the Ukrainian government formally, but in fact they are part of the teams which are provided by the West. And in that sense, Ukraine is increasingly becoming a colonized nation.
Now, just maybe one last question, because you're on a tour of different Canadian cities. I'm kind of curious to know if you have any advice for Canadian people in terms of how our government could do something to potentially alleviate the violence and the horror of the whole situation that's happening out there.
Well, of course, I'm not in a position to give advice to Canadian government, no matter who is in government. The important thing is that Canadian politics must be liberated from both the influence of U.S. Policies and from the reactionary communities within Ukraine. In this case, of course, we can remember that there are whole communities of people who came to Ukraine after the second, who came to Canada in the period after the Second World War, and who are not necessarily any kind of progressive. And the reason for them to immigrate from the former Soviet Union was not necessarily because of the bad Stalinist regime, but partly because many of these people cooperated with the Nazi-occupying forces. So unfortunately, that was a strong tradition within Ukrainian nationalist movements. And I think Ukrainian society must understand that these people, who are very often seen here as representatives of Ukrainian national traditions or interests, are only representing the most reactionary, most right-wing side of it, while probably the majority of Ukrainians even now are opposed to these politics and traditions. And in that sense, I think it's a question of democracy. Canadian political life must be, first of all, it must be really Canadian political life, so it must be determined by the Canadian issues and Canadian interests, and then people must open their eyes and see and understand what's happening, say, in Russia, in Ukraine, in Greece, in Central Europe, in Southern Europe, and understand that the struggles which are taking place there are not so different compared to the struggles and problems you have here, like the struggle for welfare state, the struggle for real independence of the country from the dominant interests and so on, for real participatory democracy. I think these struggles take place everywhere.
Boris Kagalinsky, thank you so much for sharing with us, and all the best for the rest of your Canadian tour.
Thanks.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Andrew Korybko is an American political commentator based in Moscow. He works for the Sputnik Agency and writes for Oriental Review. And he recently completed a four-part essay called The New Middle East. And this basically addresses Russian geostrategy in the Central Asian region. So, Andrew Korybko, welcome to the Global Research News Hour. It's great to have you.
Hi, I'm very glad to be here. Thank you.
Okay, so I guess maybe what we could start with is what you and other political commentators have addressed as a geostrategic masterstroke on the part of Putin, and that being the Russian intervention in Syria against the ISIL forces. Now, nominally, we're being told it's about fighting the terrorists, but I'm wondering, what is the actual goal or goals involved in this intervention?
Okay, well, the way that I look at it is, yes, I mean, this is definitely about fighting terrorists, but I think we need to take a step back and look at what those terrorists represent and the strategic interest that it kind of controls them, or rather, I think it's more accurate to say, guide them into certain directions. So with that being said, we see that ISIL has been used strategically as an instrument of American foreign policy. And it's not to suggest that there's an American on the ground in every terrorist camp, pointing them in the direction, telling them what to do, but rather the fact that because of the way the U.S. is able to structurally influence the situation, specifically with the ineffective airstrikes against ISIL, they're able to move them into this or that direction. And actually, that's what's really important here, is many people thought that up to this point, the U.S. airstrikes were unsuccessful. I argue they have been very successful in the sense of keeping ISIL corralled and moving them further in the direction of Damascus. We remember when Palmyra fell, and that's halfway there. That's halfway between Raqqa and Damascus. That happened for a reason. They moved towards Palmyra. They didn't move towards Turkey, is what I'm trying to say. Now, in terms of what Russia is trying to achieve, that being said, what I had expressed is that Russia wants to reverse the process of strategic state fragmentation that the U.S. had begun over a decade ago. And this follows in the footsteps of Zbigniew Brzezinski's Eurasian Balkans theory. And just to briefly summarize, the idea was that strategic fragmentations of states in certain geocritical areas can be used as weapons of macro destruction, if you will. And that's kind of what we saw happening. We saw that from 2003 with Iraq, the U.S. was smack dab in the middle of the Mideast. 2006, when Israel had its war in Lebanon against Hezbollah, then Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice proclaimed the beginning of a new Middle East. She said there were the birth pangs of a new Middle East. Right around that time, retired Army individual Ralph Peters published his very, very provocative study about blood borders, how a better Middle East would look, as he termed it, basically redrawing all the borders. Now we see after the Arab Spring called the revolutions, the Syrian people had fought back. One of the consequences of their patriotism was that the U.S. upped the ante, transformed the color revolution into an unconventional war, something that I term American hybrid wars, and started using this proxy mercenary army in the heart of the Mideast to carry out, for a lot cheaper than the U.S. itself directly could in Iraq, what Washington wanted to do all along, and that's redrawing the Middle East borders. Now, with the Russian anti-terrorist intervention directly targeting ISIL and other terrorist groups, this has put an end to the shenanigans. The U.S. can only redraw the Middle Eastern states' borders if it does so directly, and it does not seem willing to do that for a couple of reasons. First reason, now it's not going to directly confront Russia as some people think it's going to. Second thing is that this is very, very expensive. I mean, one of the lessons the U.S. learned from Iraq was that, well, if you're going to create the new Middle East, as it's been called, best to do it by proxy instead of paying for it yourself. And third, the United States now needs to dissipate its troops from the Mideast and transfer them to East Asia and back to Eastern Europe. This is part of the Pentagon strategy of surrounding Russia and surrounding China. But in doing so, they purposely left a void in the Mideast for the exact purpose of creating this strategic chaos, if you will, that can be guided in this or that direction. Now, who controls the area on the ground? If the U.S. isn't there directly, this is part of a strategy called Leave from Behind that I had spoken about over a year ago. Originally, it came to the forefront in 2011 Libya. U.S. said, hey, let other people do the hard lifting. We stay behind and take care of back-end tech support, logistics, intelligence, and strategy. What it means in the current reality is basically proxy domination using Turkey, using Saudi Arabia. In Eastern Europe, we have them trying to use Poland. In Southeast Asia, trying to use Japan, Vietnam, and the Philippines, basically to rule by proxy. Now, this didn't, as you see, this hasn't worked. The U.S.'s strategy has not succeeded. And I think that goes to show that, you know, you have the U.S. trying to lead from behind, but when Russia leads from in front, that kind of just spelled the end of the strategy. And I think right now that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a complete rethink of American grand strategy because Russia came in and spoiled the game, if you will. And therefore, the United States needs to figure out how it's going to respond. Now, there are some ways it could do that, but we can discuss that later if you wanted.
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of the United States and NATO had their agenda, I imagine, going back 20 years about how they were going to continually encroach on this territory, according to the edicts of Zbigniew Brzezinski's Grand Chessboard, as you pointed out. And they've been using Al-Qaeda, they've been using ISIS, mm-hmm. ISIL. They also use this instruments that you call the colored revolutions, which I assume it's having to do with, you know, just the sort of covert instigation of internal uprisings that are not to the democratic uprisings, whether it's the Orange Revolution in Ukraine or the Arab Spring and whatnot. I don't know. Do you want to comment briefly on that particular instrument and whether or not that's failing or whether that's something that will be amplified with the effective withdrawal of ISIS?
Yeah, sure. I'll be very brief about it. I think that color revolutions are really at the forefront of American foreign policy right now, because ever since the end of the Cold War, with the global quote unquote opening, as some people have called it, a lot of NGOs were able to just spill into all these states all across the world they had never been before. Western foreign influence, or just foreign influence in general, was able to transcend borders without raising any type of suspicion at those times. Now, it's not to say all NGOs are bad or anything like that, but the thing is an NGO is an instrument that can be hijacked and can be exploited, and it creates a semblance of quote-unquote plausible deniability. Basically, it can allow intelligence organizations to operate without barely any scrutiny inside the target states. And therefore, the U.S. had eventually started figuring out ways for how to tinker this instrument and really put it to its geopolitical use. And we see that with color revolutions. We see that with the writings of Gene Sharp. He is the mastermind behind the color revolutions. The organizational and operational approaches, yeah, these are taken care of by George Soros. He has a bunch of NGO color revolution groups under his belt. So in response to what's happening now, and with what looks like a conventional American drawback, it's very misleading, because asymmetrically, in terms of the unconventional applications of power, the U.S. is on the upswing. We see all over the place there's all these types of destabilizations, and they succeed best when there's some type of legitimate grievance or perceived grievance, be it an electricity hike in Yerevan, be it a quote-unquote rigged election, as they try to say, in Macedonia in the past. These types of things are taken out of proportion. They're used as ways of misleading people. And a lot of the time, color revolutions aren't just aimed internally. They're aimed towards the external audience to create international pressure on the target government with the hopes that this could be the final push that topples that government. But so I definitely expect color revolutions to be on the forefront. They're definitely going to be expanding, and I wrote a book about that available on orientalreview.org called Hybrid Wars, the Indirect Adaptive Approach to Regime Change, that meticulously studies this phenomenon.
Now, I mean, I guess the other instrument that the United States has at its disposal is just overt attacks, put together some kind of coalition of the willing or whatever. Not too popular these days, right?
Yeah, they're not too popular, and that's for a couple of reasons. I mean, everyone sees that the coalition of the willing, if you will, was created an absolutely false pretext. I mean, they didn't even bother fabricating the material evidence to coincidentally find under the sand in Iraq. I mean, they didn't even go that far. Everyone knows it was a lie. There's a lot of suspicion. But at the same time, the U.S. will militarily act when it feels compelled to, but it will try to limit its interventions, if you will, to the smallest scale possible. That's why there's been such an uptick in drone strikes and special forces. These are very, very important right now, because for the United States, they don't cost that much. There's less of a risk. There's less of a commitment. And they have more flexibility in targeting these specific objectives that they're pursuing. So now we see right now, I'll bring up just something very recent. Pentagon says that the U.S. Might possibly have boots in the ground in Syria or whatnot. They use some type of euphemism. Some people took that to mean another Iraq war, something that big. I don't think so. I think it's just stating the obvious of what's been going on for a couple of years already, and that's special forces deployment in the war on Syria in order to help shift the balance of forces in favor of terrorists, which, as I've explained, are the United States proxy forces on the ground. I think that when we look at Syria, the main goal right here is a race for Raqqa, as I have written about also on Oriental Review, that both sides, Syrian Arab Army, and quote-unquote moderate opposition, which doesn't really exist except in the imagination, are racing for ISIL's headquarters in Raqqa, because he who gets that prize will be the one who would decide either to keep Syria as a unitary state, as the Syrian Arab Army wants to, or these terrorist rebels, if they seize it, then they have a stake in creating either de facto or de jure split and federalized state. And that's kind of what the U.S. is looking right now as a fallback plan in Syria.
Okay. Now, in terms of strategic allies, you mentioned Russia's what you call the Coalition of the Righteous,
yes,
involving Syria, Iraq, and Iran. And I suppose the Kurds, I don't know if they're like how tight they are right now, but then the United States has its strategic allies, namely Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Turkey, among other others in the region. And you know what? As things are evolving, how do you see those? How loose are those alliances? Are they pretty intact, or do you see anyone switching over to? For strategic reasons, to another side? Are we seeing maneuvering, trying to tempt Iran or some other elements, the Kurds in particular? How, talk about those different alliances and where the weak spots might be on either side.
Okay, I think this is a fantastic question. So to begin addressing it, I want to recall something that just happened last week, and it even took me a bit by surprise. And that's the creation of an anti-terrorist coordination center in Amman, the capital of Jordan, between that monarchy and the Russian Federation. Barely anybody saw that coming, because Jordan, since 1994, has been under, if one will, triple occupation between Israel, the United States, and Saudis in a strategic sense. But looking back on it, well, King Abdullah II has been pretty cozy with, President Putin. And actually, I think Mr. Abdullah has realized that, he realized a lot quicker, if you will, and in a more pragmatic way than Erdogan, that, hey, what you reap, you will also sow. So now he's kind of in a panic mode, wanting to stop terrorist infiltration into Jordan and route back to Saudi Arabia. So now in terms of these vulnerabilities, that's very interesting. Jordan now is trying to balance between four actors. But what I'm looking for, and as you mentioned, are the Kurds. Well, they have their own interests, and that's to create Kurdistan. They're very, very clear about it. They're very forthcoming. They even said, even the Iraqi portion of Kurdistan said over the summer that, yeah, they might even move towards an independence referendum. I mean, we know what they want to do. So right now, it seems as though they're kind of going towards the highest bidder in a way. And they've been working with this Coalition of the Righteous, which I think is great. It doesn't mean to imply that money switched hands in this case, but that they know, the ones in Syria at least, that for sure they'd be a lot more protected under what, Russia and the Syrian Arab Army are pursuing than what the United States is pursuing. But that could change. I mean, that could really, really change depending upon the promises that are made and Israel's influence over the Kurdish regional government in Iraq. So that's something to really, really watch, because Israel is buying oil from the Kurds in northern Iraq, and they've also have previously supplied them. So it's a big mess there. Now, you had mentioned Iran a bit, and that's something I'm looking at, because over the summer and the aftermath of the Iranian nuclear agreement, I was a little bit nervous, to be honest with you, Michael. I was nervous about where Iran was headed, because I don't exactly trust the moderate trend that was in Tehran at the time. I saw a lot of opportunity for manipulation on the outside, a lot of ways to mislead the country. But thankfully, for now, it seems as though my fears have abated, because Ayatollah Khamenei's statements about the United States, what he has been doing, and the fact that Iran has committed to this Coalition of the Righteous, I mean, it just slaps the United States in the face and says, you know what, we have our own red line with what we'll do. We'll talk, nuclear energy, but that's it. We're done. So I think right now there's not much to worry about when it comes to Iran and Russia. And plus, of course, Iran also has another layer of interest, and that's helping its Syrian ally. I mean, those two countries have been very close even before this. So I don't see Iran kind of falling out of place. But what I'm really concerned about, and I think everyone should be concerned about, is the balkanization, if one will, of the U.S.'s two main strategic partners in the Mideast. This is Turkey and Saudi Arabia, not counting Israel. If you ask me, everything the U.S. does in the Middle East is to protect and perpetuate the existence of Israel. But looking at Turkey right now, we see that the state, it's very, very unstable. I have been writing about that ever since this summer. I was one of the first analysts to write that this Kurdish insurgency might be the sign of something larger and a lot longer. At the time, the analysis was kind of dismissed by some experts, but now everyone's echoing it. So we see right now, not only is there a Kurdish insurgency that could actually turn into a full-fledged civil war in Turkey after the election. Mind you, right now they have unilaterally stopped fighting on the Kurd side in order to have peaceful elections and not be blamed for any type of electoral rigging that Erdogan might want to do, like just say pushing back elections, it looked like in the past. But also you have terrorist attacks inside the Turkish heartland. Whether or not those are a part of a false flag operation, it could very well be. But from the military perspective in Turkey, they have to juggle between so many imperatives right now. International strikes in Iraq on the Iraqi Kurds, now cross-border firing on the Syrian Kurds, then, you know, fighting this insurgency in southeastern Turkey against the Kurds again, protecting the homeland from terrorist attacks, then being on Syrian standby, as they're called, along the border just for show. I mean, this is a lot. The last thing they need is any more destabilization. Historically, Turkey has resorted to coups, military coups, in order to restore stability. I say if there is no conclusive result in the upcoming election, very well, we might see repeat of history. Now, the last thing I want to mention towards your question is Saudi Arabia. This used to be such a rich country, and it still is comparatively, but they're just bleeding money right now. And they're bleeding money because of this energy war that they are in with the United States. This was the biggest miscalculation, one of the biggest miscalculations the House of Saud had ever made. They thought they can team up with the U.S., take down Russia back in December, drop the oil prices. They thought it would be a repeat of the 1980s. They just wipe their hands, go home. Everyone would pat each other on the back. It didn't work out that way. Then, classical security dilemma occurred where Saudi Arabia and the U.S. started figuring, well, hey, now I can knock my main rival out of the market. We'll have some quote-unquote friendly competition. And maybe just like some good friends that might start pushing each other for fun, someone takes it the wrong way, and now there's a slugfest. That's what's happening in terms of the energy market between the United States and Saudi Arabia. It was unintentional. Now, both sides are trying to take each other out. The U.S. will keep printing money. It'll keep diving down as far as it can go. But Saudi Arabia cannot perpetuate these type of policies. They're already running for their reserves. They're trying to panic, they're trying to transition to a financial economy, bring in all this foreign investment. It's too much, too quick. They don't have the infrastructure to do it. And not only that, it's never going to be enough. And if the U.S. is able to keep prices so low so quick, and the Saudis are just bleeding money in Yemen, well, they're also bleeding a lot of their own blood in Yemen, as well as the rest of the Gulf for this war that they're waging in there. And they're also, I mean, they don't know what to do. And then we have all these whispers about possible coup against, you know, against the King Salman. He has Alzheimer's. He doesn't know what he's thinking. A very easy, fertile ground right there. And terrorist attacks inside the Saudi interior. Their spawn, ISIL, has turned on them. And the Saudis suspect maybe they're being directed to do so by the United States in order to force a capitulation on the part of Riyadh in this grand energy cold war that I just spoke to you about. So if they fall apart, and if Turkey continues to fall apart, you will actually have a complete restructuring in the Middle East. And in that way, the United States would be completely removed until it finds the appropriate proxy rump states to project more influence in. But now we're talking about more of a long-term analysis. I just wanted to introduce our listeners to this line of thinking.
What you're describing is Saudi Arabia and Turkey kind of involved in their own Vietnams, if you will, while the successful strikes against ISIS, ISIL, in Syria and Iraq are bringing more stability to Syria and Iraq, and essentially you're seeing that transfer where, you know, Iraq and Syria are becoming more stable, and Russia's allies and Saudi and Turkey are becoming weaker and weaker, and they're the United States' main strategic allies.
Yes, you definitely hit the nail on the head, because the absolute irony is that about, you know, a couple of years ago, everyone thought, oh, well, look, you know, Russia's historical allies, Syria, Iraq, they were seen as the most unstable and fractured states in the region. Now we flash forward, it's almost the end of 2015, and what are the two states that look like they're the most on the brink? Turkey, for sure, Saudi Arabia right behind it. And which two states are now beginning to stabilize and actually beginning to coalesce in terms of, you know, their governments are now regaining more control over their territories, you're trying to wipe out terrorists? Well, that's Syria and Iraq. I mean, talk about a complete geostrategic reversal right here. But this goes to show you that the lead from behind strategy for creating the quote unquote new Middle East that the U.S. wanted to do, this was never something that was going to succeed. It was so fragile. It was so fickle. There were so many possibilities for it to go wrong, because at the end of the day, Michael, no one can ever completely harness or control chaos. The theory sounds great on paper. It sounds great. It looks great. Maybe the computer simulations might have given the U.S. some positive feedback. But in reality, if something can go wrong, especially when you're dealing with chaos, more than likely it will go wrong in these cases, especially when you're pushing it towards that point. Now, we look at what Russia's doing. Russia has a very, very limited intervention in Syria, and they're restricting that only towards airstrikes. Of course, they're giving, you know, intelligence, reconnaissance. They're also giving diplomatic, political support as well. But in terms of on the ground, it's only limited to airstrikes and the cruise missile strike that happened a couple of weeks back from the Caspian. So, you know, this is in no way is this Russia's Vietnam at all, unlike, you know, unlike what some Western commentators try to say that it's an Afghan redux. But we see, as you mentioned, I mean, Turkey's in its own Vietnam, basically. I mean, 25% of the population is Kurdish. Actually, by some estimates, the Kurds are going to outnumber the rest of all the ethnic groups in Turkey in the coming decades. Then you have Saudi Arabia. They thought they would just, you know, have a 1-2 week, maybe 3 week at the most, intervention bombing campaign in Yemen, stretching on into its eighth, almost ninth month. So now we see, again, unexpected situations started happening. Erdogan thought he can play the card of Turkish nationalism after being dealt such an embarrassing and historic defeat in the last elections. So he thought he can just kind of tinker with the ceasefire with the Kurds, kind of, you know, he can just check off the boxes. Okay, nationalism, attack Turks, I mean, attack Kurds. He can kind of draw some nationalist votes, maybe decrease support for the Kurdish party that was running. But it didn't work out that way. The Kurds said, hey, we're fighting back. This ceasefire is done. Look what happened.
Could you talk briefly about the refugee situation and how this is playing into the whole scenario? Because it seems to me that while, you know, the Western powers can talk about, oh, this evil guy Assad or the Russians or this or that, but you know, when you're and maybe you can propagandize the public into saying that, yeah, we got to send in our jets and get in there. But if you got a huge, like hundreds of thousands of refugees being generated and coming to your front doorstep, that can change your whole interpretation of this whole situation. So how is the refugee situation affecting the way this you know, Russian-U.S. standoff is taking place?
Well, okay, this is a huge topic, so I'm going to try to be brief. I'm going to try to summarize in the most concise way. What most people think about the refugee crisis isn't real, in the sense that they think that all these people are fleeing, you know, President Assad's forces and this and that, and they're only recent. That's not true. Actually, most of those refugees have actually had already left the country a couple of years ago. And the majority of them that had left, now mind you, there are more refugees inside Syria as internally displaced people than decided to leave. That's another fact that's left out of the conversation, very conveniently for the United States. So anyhow, you have about 2 million refugees that are in Turkey, and they weren't allowed to leave. They're stuck in internment camps, basically. We can call them concentration camps, internment camps, refugee facilities. It's all the same thing in this case. Well, President Erdogan, because he has strategic motivations to join the EU and use this, even just the talk of it as an electioneering slogan, he decided, hey, look, I'm going to let these guys go, and I'm going to guide them north, basically into Greece, into the EU. And, hey, just going to wreak havoc. It's going to be their problem. Then they're going to say, okay, now we need to support this quote-unquote buffer zone in northern Syria. That didn't happen exactly how he thought, because Russia's anti-terrorist intervention has made sure that Turkey will not have any type of formal intervention on the scale that Erdogan had previously anticipated. But what's more is that the United States also has a very big strategic dog in this fight. And it isn't only just over information and ginning up support for an expanded war in Syria. It is to perpetually weaken the EU by forcing demographic changes inside the countries, creating such a strategy of internal tension, decades-long strategy of internal tension, that it can keep these countries in check. On top of that, the United States also knew that because of the security risk that this is, I mean, of course, many terrorists are infiltrating in it. This is turning into a terrorist pipeline, unfortunately. But in terms of how the EU is reacting, we see states that people even forgot they had militaries, like Germany, Austria, Slovenia, they're mobilizing their military to protect their borders. All of a sudden now, snap, they have a justification for upping their defense budgets when before they were just decreasing them, especially in the context of the Great Recession. From an American standpoint, that's perfect. I'd like to recall, everyone to recall, former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates' last speech when he said all of the U.S.'s NATO partners need to step up their game or whatnot, to paraphrase him. Well, now, well, they didn't realize they'd be increasing their defense budgets because of a pre-planned, manipulated refugee crisis that the U.S. and Turkey doubly released on the EU. But now, hey, next year, you're going to see them increasing their defense budget because they need to. And the U.S. is going to make sure that some of those increased defense commitments are redirected towards this new Cold War and, quote-unquote, containing Russia and remilitarizing Eastern Europe. So this is kind of the larger context of what's going on. There are more specific regional peculiarities of what the U.S. and Turkey may want to achieve in the Balkans that I've been writing about. But people can check out my articles on Facebook about that. This could definitely be a whole nother radio show to discuss. But just touching on what you mentioned, that's generally what's going on with the refugee crisis. But I do want to mention as a closing comment on that, there are real refugees that are going through. Then there are also copycat refugees that aren't really refugees. They're not even from Syria. They're not even from Iraq. They're from anywhere from Somalia, Algeria, all the way through Afghanistan, and they're going through. So they're taking advantage of this. And you do have a considerable amount of people that are taking these treks, not because they're escaping any war or violence, but because they want to abuse the economic benefits that they know that they can receive in the EU. So you also have that happening, and you have a very disproportionate percentage of young military-age males that are going as well. And that's creating a lot of fear in Europe, a lot of tension. Now there's political crises. Now we see, as I mentioned, there are a lot more levers for maneuverability in terms of how the U.S. can influence these governments, both from the top down and from the bottom up. Now there is a lot more of a fertile ground for possible color revolutions. The entire continent is now infested and susceptible.
Well, Andrew Korobko, as you mentioned, this is like a huge political topic, and one that we can possibly continue in a future discussion. But I'm afraid I have to close for now. But I want to thank you very much for your rather brilliant and incisive analysis on this whole situation. And I hope we can continue our conversation at a later date.
Okay, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Andrew Korobko, American political commentator based in Moscow, working for the Sputnik agency. He writes for Oriental Review. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.